This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Andy Roy. Today is April 30th, 2003. It is 8:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. Roy, you are in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. Sir, we left off last time with you getting back in country, transferring to the 227th after your first tour. And would you like to pick up from there?
Yes. I arrived back in country, and I came back into country at the 90th Replacement Depot down in Long Bend near Benoit in the Saigon area, same place I had arrived at on my first tour. There were some difficulties in paperwork. I forget what it was. And I had to go back to my battalion in the 173rd. And they were operating down in Tooewa still. So I flew down to Tooewa, hopped one of the flights going in that direction, and got the paperwork taken care of. While I was there, I had heard that the unit had gotten into a real big fight, tremendous battle. Very little support available. They have a place called Bao Lock, which is up near Bama, too. So there was a hospital, an evac hospital, on the Army base at Tooewa, and I went over. I saw a couple of the friends that I had that were at the battle, and they told me about it. Told me about several friends and acquaintances that have been killed and seriously wounded. So
how did you handle that? You know, you had been home on leave, and they're in this nasty fight. How did you deal with that?
Well, I missed that battle by approximately a week and a half. It was a battle that could have been very simply won, but the company commander hesitated. What had happened was there was a report of some North Vietnamese units that had pulled into the Bao Lock region. So they called in just one company. That's all, just one company, C Company, 4th Battalion, 503rd, 3rd Infantry Regiment, 173rd, to go up there. Their only artillery support was a South Vietnamese 155-millimeter artillery battery, which they weren't too thrilled about. You like to have your own artillery support. Anyway, they were patrolling through the mountains, and my squad was on point that day. And they started going up a trail, up a hill, and suddenly as they got up towards the top of the hill, they heard some Vietnamese voices. They snuck up a little bit closer, and they heard more voices, and it was just normal talking. There was no alarm or anything like that. If the company commander had immediately put the company on line and assaulted up over the rest of the hill, they would have taken the position simply by complete surprise. But he hesitated and he hesitated and he hesitated, and suddenly a North Vietnamese soldier noticed their presence, announced the alarm to the rest of the North Vietnamese unit that was there. The guys that I talked to told me they could hear North Vietnamese yelling commands, running around, and then they were told to proceed further. But by that time, of course, the enemy was alerted. They proceeded another maybe 25, 30 meters, and suddenly, I think it was the whole left side or the whole right side just of the jungle just opened fire on them. They had a very difficult time disengaging. Then they tried another assault and another assault. They took a lot of casualties. The artillery support, 155-millimeter guns are not the average artillery for close-in support. Those are usually 105-millimeter guns. A 155-millimeter gun is a lot larger and can't be brought in as closely. So they had to do without support initially. They were pinned down. Company commander had crawled forward and fell into a well. And they were unable to disengage from the enemy. Nighttime fell. The company commander spent the whole night down in the well. And the next morning, they assaulted again, and the North Vietnamese were gone. It turned out to be a combination hospital and, I forget if it was company or regimental-sized position. But they retrieved the company commander. I forget the number of dead that they took. In the end, it was a company from the 101st Airborne Division was flown in an emergency to relieve them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were relieved and pulled back. And the 101st Airborne, either that one company or maybe even a whole battalion came in then to search for the rest of that unit.
Mm-hmm.
And to gather up all the enemy equipment and the like, plus the American equipment that was laying around. So as the war drew on, company commanders and the like, battalion commanders, some of them, more and more of them, became a little hesitant to commit to immediate attacks because of the very serious pressure in this country over casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Without the realization, and anybody who has a lot of experience in combat knows, you may make an attack and take a lot of casualties during this one battle, but if you can defeat the enemy in the longer run, you take less casualties.
Right.
But people that don't understand that, well, let's say a mother especially,
mm-hmm.
and that news media, you know, they just blow it up into casualties. They're
mm-hmm.
not military people. They're not looking ahead. They're not understanding, you know, that you pay something now in order to save later on.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be aggressive. This also keeps the enemy off balance and makes them less effective.
Right.
As the war went on, further and further and further and further, especially after I left, this became even more so among units.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are not aggressive and you do not always go on to the attack, usually in the long run, you're going to end up taking more casualties. At the very least, you're going to raise enemy morale. You're going to let them get away to fight another day,
mm-hmm.
Maybe from a position that's even stronger. But this was one of those situations.
Did you think that, as the war went on, did you think that the U.S. policy of Vietnamization, turning the war over to the Vietnamese, was going to work or not?
At that particular time, I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. I had worked with Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
in the 173rd, on and off, and especially with the Montagnards up in the mountains. And I had seen them do very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of leadership. It's a matter of the right equipment. It's a matter of establishing an army, which is hard to do from scratch. And that's basically what they had to do. I really didn't know at that time if it could work. I did feel that we shouldn't pull out all at once.
Mm-hmm.
We should have done a Korean kind of thing. Maybe left four divisions, you know, over a long run
mm-hmm.
as the thing winds down. But, you know, I was only in Spec 4 and left, so.
Right.
Of course, I was hoping for a good outcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
so when you got back in and you found out about the battle, had you already transferred to the 227th? Had that happened?
No, I had to take care of this paperwork, and I forget what the issue was.
Mm-hmm.
So after I talked to the guys in the hospital, I went back to 90th Replacement Depot, and from there went to On K, which was then the base camp for the 1st Cavalry Division. It was a huge base camp established by them in 1965. At the time, it was being shared with the 173rd Airborne Brigade. And eventually, the 1st Cav Division would completely abandon on K, and the 173rd and some Arvin units and a few other American units from the 4th Infantry Division would take it over. But it was a massive base. I talked to a couple of guys who've been back to Vietnam and have been to On K, and they say that it's like there was nothing ever there.
Really?
One little section is used by the Vietnamese, current Vietnamese military. But they say you can walk through it. Now and then in the fields you might find a little piece of sandbag or a piece of barbed wire. And this place was literally a city. There was a big mountain in the center of it called Hong Kong Mountain. And it had a big 1st Cav Division patch on it with a radio relay station on top of that. And, of course, the Cav Division patch is gone, and there's nothing on top of the mountain. But I was stunned when I heard that they said you could never tell there was anything there. But I went to On K, signed into 1st Cav Division, and at the time, I was told, and I'd already known, that the 1st Cav Division was operating up in I Corps, up in Quang Tri Province mainly. I then flew up to Quang Tri, and at the time the forward base camp was at a place called Camp Evans, which was, 35 miles south of DMZ maybe. On Highway 1, just off to one side. I arrived with a number of other replacements, and right away they took us to sort of a training school. Everybody coming into Vietnam had to go through these training schools. They had different names for them. Jungle School, basically, was what it was.
Why did you have to go to that after you'd spent a year?
Well, they just said everybody had to.
Okay.
So I arrived there, you know, in trucks with everybody else from the airfield. And I'm standing there, I'm saying, this is ridiculous. I don't need this. So I kind of looked around. Everybody was milling around. I threw my duffel bag up over my shoulder, acted like I was supposed to be doing what I was doing, and just plain walked out the front gate of the school. And hitched a ride. Guy asked me where I was going. He was in a deuce and a half, 2.5-ton truck. And I told him I was, had just been assigned to the 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion. He said, I know where they are. I'll drive you over there. So I drove over. I wasn't quite sure if I was going to hear about being missing, because obviously they had my name expecting me. But I said, what the heck, what are they going to do, send me to Vietnam? So I arrived at the 227th. I reported in to battalion headquarters, and battalion assigned me to C Company. I reported in C Company as a replacement door gunner and was assigned to the 2nd Door Gunner Platoon.
Tell me again why you wanted to be a door gunner.
Grunts, infantrymen, combat troops, and helicopter crewmen were very intimately tied together. I mean, helicopters were how you got your resupply. Helicopters were the people that transferred you, moved you from one place to another. Helicopters got you out of the field if you were wounded. They would also be your last trip out of the field if you were killed. They were your communications with the outside world. And helicopter crews have been known to take such chances supporting grunts that at times they just shouldn't have taken the chances and paid a price. But, you know, we could always depend upon them. We also They were kind of like the postman. There were two ways of getting mail out of the field. You either put it in this red postal bag, or you, when the helicopter landed, you could run up to the door gunner, who was on the right-hand side of the ship,
mm-hmm.
or you could run up to the door gunner, the gunner on the left-hand side of the ship, who was actually the crew chief of the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he owned the helicopter, and then he doubled as a gunner on the left side. A lot of guys didn't know that one of them was a crew chief. You know, to us, they were just gunners. You ran up to them and you handed them the letter or whatever, and they'd take it and they'd put it inside a pouch behind this big 1-inch thick steel plate we used to wear over our chest,
mm-hmm.
and it was known as a chicken plate. It was a pocket on the inside. And it was a sacred obligation for a gunner to make sure that that mail was mailed when you arrived back at the rear.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place just for depositing mail. So, I mean, the dependence, the reliability, you know, was so important. If the helicopter went down, you know, in turn, the grunts would go through hell and high water to get to the helicopter and rescue any survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Or take out the dead and wounded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, helicopter crewmen knew they could depend upon that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I really enjoyed flying. I mean, it's an open helicopter. The doors are wide open. We're all packed in. It's a type of flying that you just don't do in civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a military aircraft. It's loud. You can't talk to each other. Except to put your hands, cup your hands right over somebody's ear, and yell into it.
Mm-hmm.
Might be hot in the ground, but there's this fresh air just rushing through the cabin and the like, and the thing's vibrating, and it's kind of exciting. A lot of times you're going to make a helicopter assault someplace, or you may be going into the rear for whatever reason. That's great. We used to really like flying around and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew also that most of the time, you know, at the end of the day, unless there was some sort of an emergency or whatever, or some special night missions, then most of them slept in tents back, either in the forward base camp or, a fire support base or something like that, and that's always attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go to sleep in the mud or on the dirt and the rocks and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought that was great for
right.
us. And we still had that connection with grunts. Now, there were a lot of guys that did what I did, an awful lot of guys.
Mm-hmm.
Infantrymen volunteered to become door gunners. So... That's why I wanted to become a gunner.
Okay.
The reality of the whole thing turned out to be completely different to me,
okay.
or for me, anyway.
Okay.
I reported into the platoon, and I remember the platoon sergeant was a Sergeant Moffett,
mm-hmm.
who I've been desperately trying to find and have not had any luck with. Right away made friends with another gunner who was on his second tour by the name of Townsend. And he kind of took me under his wing a little bit. So that night I took my first flight. They try and get you into the chopper and, you know, up on your first flight right away. So
mm-hmm.
what it was basically flying the division commander from one side of the perimeter to the other side of the perimeter.
Okay.
Keeping in mind that Camp Evans was also a massive site.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably a mile and a half across, 2 miles across. It was dark. We picked up the division commander, I forget where, and we're someplace inside the perimeter. And we're flying him across the perimeter back to his headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
So we took him over, dropped them off and were flying back, and all of a sudden, it's like we lost lift in the helicopter,
mm-hmm.
and you could feel it starting to drop kind of vertically real fast. And you wear a helmet, and in that helmet, there's a little microphone and earphones, and you can hear conversation among the crew.
Mm-hmm.
If the pilot switches the radio, you can hear other conversations among helicopters or whatever, but you can always hear among the crew. And it was a floor button that you stepped on if you wanted to talk. There was also a hand button on a cord you could press if you wanted to talk.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, I hear the pilot and the co-pilot saying, "Oh, my God, here it goes again. We're going in. We're going in. We're going to crash." And the helicopter's coming down, 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 down real fast,
mm-hmm.
Still staying straight. And we get to about, oh, God, I don't know, about 500 feet. And all of a sudden, it's like I felt the blade bite into the air again. The engine picked up sound, and boom, we started to slow down, and then we just flew forward. And I'm wondering, what the hell happened?
Mm-hmm.
And there are some lights inside the cabin they can turn on. And the lights up front turned on, and I looked forward, and the Peter pilot, or the assistant pilot who sits in the left side,
mm-hmm.
was turned back grinning at me, and the crew chief was turned back around the corner looking at me and grinning
mm-hmm.
at me. I had just been
initiated
through a initiation.
Right.
What had happened was it's kind of like driving a car with a manual transmission.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do is you kick in the clutch, you disengage the rotors from the transmission, and going down through the air, as the air rushes up through the blade, you go into a condition called auto rotation.
Mm-hmm.
The air actually turns the blades, and they've already had some momentum to begin with. And if you lose your engine power, you'll hit the ground harder than you normally would.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you can survive it.
Right.
And this is what they did. So, I was lucky.
Uh-huh.
Some guys, sometimes they'd accomplish something. And, especially a pilot, like let's say just before he's going home, his last flight, the crew would pick him up, and they'd take him around to the back of the helicopter. And the back of the helicopter had this large bar that kind of came down and then straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so that if the end of the tail hit the ground, the tail rotor, it would stop the tail from going down so that the tail rotor wouldn't hit the ground. And it was always known of as the stinger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'd take him over there, and they would thread from his foot up into one leg of his pants and walk off and leave him hanging like that. There were a lot of little things like that.
What did you say to these guys? What did you do after?
I smiled. I knew what was going
uh-huh.
on.
Uh-huh.
And I laughed. And the aircraft commander who was on the right said something. I don't remember what. I don't know. Welcome to the cab or something like that. You
mm-hmm.
know. And they were all laughing. And I laughed back. I realized what it was.
Right.
You know? So,
okay.
And the next day was spent signing paperwork, doing this, doing that. I had to sign a document. We used to support a unit called SOG. You might have
mm-hmm.
heard of it.
Special Operations Group?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Special SOG. Operations Group.
Mm-hmm.
They worked for MACB. They did operations known as Over the Fence
mm-hmm.
in Laos, Cambodia, and North Vietnam. I had to sign a document saying that if I was to go on one of these missions, that I wasn't to talk to anybody about it for 10 years
mm-hmm.
under penalty of up to 10 years in jail.
Right.
I wasn't quite sure what it was, but what the heck, I signed it. And then the day after that, I started flying missions. We usually flew 6 days a week, and we had one day off. Now, that one day, we did details and the like, but we didn't have to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, by the manual, for helicopter pilots, helicopter pilots weren't supposed to fly more than 4 or 5 hours a day due to a fatigue factor. Well, just like the Germans did a study that infantrymen shouldn't carry more than 30 pounds because you reduce their effectiveness, practical expedience and urgency dictates a change in what you know you should and shouldn't do. To fly 8 to 10, sometimes even more hours, was not unusual. And I got to tell you, those pilots were good. Young men, 22, 23, most of them warrant officers. They weren't addressed. They were not addressed as sir. They were addressed as Mister. And they were good. I knew some of the tight, small LZs that helicopters had to go into, you know, from being a grunt. I really loved flying at first. I can remember my first CA. I was already aware, totally aware of what was going on because I'd been a grunt. I must have done that about 2-3 days after I got in.
So you had volunteered for SOG, Special Observation Group? You had volunteered for this?
No.
Okay.
I was just told signing this paper.
Okay. Okay.
It wasn't even explained to me what it was until I talked to some of the guys. But anyway, my first CA, we landed some troops in the just in a valley, maybe two mountain ranges in from the flatlands where Camp Evans was located, and the place had been pretty well shot up with artillery and airstrikes before we landed. And we landed, and the first wave that goes in, all the door gunners, as you're coming in, you'll come in line if there's room enough for 3 or 4 helicopters. The maximum usually in a stick, unless it's something special, a stick is usually 6 ships. Sometimes the LZ can take 6 ships. Other times it can take maybe only 1 ship, or 2 ships, or 3 ships. But this area was big enough to take in all 6. And as you're coming in, the artillery's firing, the command and control helicopter overhead watches as you're coming in, notifies the artillery, known as the Red Legs, that you're on final approach, and then orders the artillery to fire their last round. Well, as all 6 guns are firing, 1 gun is assigned to fire the last round, and the last round is a white phosphorus round, which makes a very big plume, snow white. You can't miss it out in the woods, of course. And choppers are coming in line. The helicopter gunships pull in one on each side, and we pull in. And we wait to see that white phosphorus round. Now, if the explosions keep going and that white phosphorus round isn't seen, the guy in charge of the stick of helicopters or command and control will abort the mission and make another go around. And I'm sure the artillery commander then gets his rear end shoot.
How often did that happen?
Never to me.
Okay.
But still, you watch for that, right? That round, that white phosphorus round comes in, it's like a signal. All of a sudden, off to the right and the left, the gunships escorting us suddenly start opening up with rockets, with miniguns, machine guns, automatic grenade launchers. They kind of take over. So that the LZ and the tree line around the LZ is just constantly, there's no let up in the fire hitting it, in case there's somebody surrounding it. You keep their heads down. And then as the helicopters themselves really start to come in, the gunships break off and go into a circle, one behind the other, right above where the choppers are landing. And just as you're starting to come in, the door gunner is opening up, firing on each side. And you're just firing into every bush. If you don't see a target, you just fire any place anybody could be hiding.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is if somebody's there, you're keeping their heads down. You're protecting the helicopter. It's vulnerable at that point. You stop, you get down, and you don't stop firing until you touch down and the grunts jump off the ship and start to go out. And then you have to stop firing so you don't hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes this operation is so quick, the rear, the helicopter usually comes in at a slight angle with the front up.
Mm-hmm.
The rear of the skids will touch the ground, it'll rock forward to the front part of the skids,
mm-hmm.
and then go off. And infantrymen are taught, get off that helicopter now. And if anybody hesitated, he would either be pulled immediately off, or the helicopter would just take off with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he'd be in big trouble. But I never saw that happen either.
Okay.
But the main thing is to keep the fire going in on the first flight and the like until the grunts can get out. Now, the grunts run out. They form, as the helicopters are taken off, they form two lines, one on the right, one on the left. And as a second lift is starting to come in, and sometimes it's right behind you, or sometimes you got to wait for up to 20 minutes for the choppers you do have, if you're limited,
mm-hmm.
to go back, pick up the next group, and bring them in. But what happens is the two helicopter gunships stay flying in circles above you. Artillery knows right where you are. The command and control helicopter is up there and looking and can call in or adjust artillery fire, helicopter gunship fire, tactical air support, mortar fire, whatever. The GIs in the two parallel lines immediately expand out and form a perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
When the second wave comes in, the gunships and the door gunners don't fire, of course, because now there's friendlies on the LZ.
Right.
Unless it's a hot LZ. If it's a hot LZ, you get the word that it's a red LZ or hot LZ.
Mm-hmm.
That means there's enemy, that there are enemy there. Then when you go in, usually there's artillery firing in support. It lifts again as the next group of ships come in. Gunships take over, and they already know pretty much where the enemy is. And then they let up as the helicopters come in. The door gunners open up and fire only at a known seen and identified target.
Okay.
Otherwise, again, it get in, touch ground. All the grunts jump off as quick as possible, and that helicopter is out of there. And as we go out, you generally know where the perimeter on the ground is, and you just fire beyond it into the trees. And the idea is just to get them the bad guys to get their heads down or flinch for a second,
mm-hmm.
because then you're low, and it only takes that couple of seconds to be behind some trees, so you're not presenting a very good target.
Mm-hmm.
That only happened to me as a grunt and as a door gunner, maybe three times.
Okay.
Because no commander is going to knowingly drop you in to a hot LZ.
Right.
And number one, the helicopter commander, the aviation commander, won't let him because he's not going to endanger his ship. You want to be able to land, get organized, and start moving in the direction you want to move in. So if you're going after an enemy unit, you'll land nearby. But you'll also have scout ships go in, check it out. You might have long-range reconnaissance patrols that have been in there,
mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Who taught you all these procedures? Who told you all of this? Or did you kind of pick this up?
Generally other guys. This one guy that took me under his wing, a black guy named Towns.
Mm-hmm.
Not Townsend, Towns, that was his name.
How do you spell
that? He'd been a gunner in the Mekong Delta on his first tour.
How do you spell his name? Is it
Towns, T-O-W-N-S.
Okay.
And I've been desperately looking for that man, and I can't find him.
Hmm.
And then other gunners, the crew chiefs, some of the stuff I already knew being a grunt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just watch and you pick up on what's going on. Aviation units like that did not mind getting infantrymen for door gunners at all, because you had somebody already had a pretty good idea what's going on.
Right.
So
you had some aspect of respect from these guys because you had already been there on the ground and knew the routine.
Well, let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
Generally, yeah, there's some respect for that. When you're in the military, if you've already been in a unit that's been in combat,
mm-hmm.
then you wear the patch of that unit on your right shoulder.
Okay.
The unit you are currently serving with is on your left shoulder. So I had the patch from the 173rd Airborne Brigade on my right shoulder, and I had the 1st Cav Division patch on my left shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been there about 4 days, and the platoon sergeant, Moffett, come up to me and said, "Roy, I got to talk to you about something." And I said, "What is it?" And he says, "Well, there's some guys bitching about you." "Bitching about me? I just got here. What'd I do?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "You're wearing the 173rd Airborne Brigade patch." And I said, "Well, yeah, but it's on my right shoulder, where it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I served with that unit." And he said, "Yeah, I know." He says, "I got no problem with that, and that's the way the regulations cover it and everything, and I'm certainly not going to order you or anything to take it off." I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know. He said, I know you went through a lot with the 173rd. But there are some guys that are just plain jerks. I mean, there are jerks in civilian society. There are jerks in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "They're bitching and moaning and pissing and groaning about it, and you might start hearing some sarcasm." And he said, "My advice is, why don't you just take it off for now?"
Hmm.
And I was very offended by that.
Mm-hmm.
I really was. Because that was those people with small minds. I contemplated it, and decided, what the hell? You know, I'm in a new unit, in combat. I don't need any hassles from anybody right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things I was learning. I have to help pull maintenance on the helicopters and stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll cut the patch off. So I took a razor blade and cut through the threads and took it off. But I was very resentful.
Mm-hmm.
I never encountered anything that I could remember. But, and then I never heard anything. Later on, I sewed it back on.
How long until you sewed it back on?
Oh, I don't know, 2 months.
Okay.
How
were they then?
After a while, I just said, by then, I was completely ensconced in the unit. I had my place.
Mm-hmm.
I had earned my place. And my feeling was, you don't like it, tough shit.
Right.
And if you don't like it, we'll go out behind a tent and you can try and take the thing off. Yourself. But I never heard anything after that.
Okay.
Because I wasn't a new guy. So I sewed the patch back on.
Okay.
But, you know, you run into these things. Like I said, in civilian life, you'll run into military life, too.
Now, when you went on your next tour with the 327th,
uh-huh.
did you have the 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion patch or the 1st Cav patch on your right shoulder? As well as
I wore the 173rd Airborne Brigade patch.
Okay.
Because I figured I had my choice, but I figured going back into a parachute infantry regiment, and it would probably inspire more respect if I wore the patch from another parachute
mm-hmm.
infantry regiment, because
mm-hmm.
paratroopers are united just like Marines are.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay.
So I wore the 173rd.
Okay.
Sometimes you didn't have the opportunity to put a patch on. Like in the 173rd and the 101st. See, in the 1st Cav, somebody did your laundry for you. I mean, you only had to wear your uniform 2 days and
mm-hmm.
then throw it in laundry and, you know, and you had more. But when you're a grunt out in the field, you're wearing those fatigues for a month. They literally stand up by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the people that wash them could stand the smell, but And a lot of them came back, and they never did have, you know, your name on it. They may have had the 101st patch, that's all, mm-hmm. you know. But it was you never got the same pairs back again. And a big pile was thrown on the ground, and everybody kind of jumped in and hoped to God they could find a pair that fit your particular size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the infantry it was a little different.
Okay.
But when I first got there, I first reported in, I wore the 173rd Airborne Brigade badge.
Okay.
Yeah, well, go on.
Okay. So, tell me about your operations. You started after your initial assault into an LZ. Tell me what your operations with the 227th were like.
The average mission was called Ass and Trash.
Mm-hmm.
And that was moving troops around and moving supplies to those troops.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning, if we weren't flying night missions, in the morning we'd report up to operations, and there'd be a big board. And the individual helicopters were identified by the last three numbers of the serial number of the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So if the last three numbers of one helicopter was 469, that helicopter was known as 469er,
mm-hmm.
or 469. And all these numbers were put on the board on the left-hand side. And what you do is you look around for your name,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that's the ship that you were assigned to for that day. Usually, and this varied by units, but in the first cab, the only person who usually was with the helicopter every day was the crew chief.
Okay.
And usually every day, the aircraft commander, the assistant aircraft commander, known as the Peter pilot, and the door gunner were different.
Okay.
I very rarely operated with the same guys 2 days in a row.
How did you like that? Do you think that was a detriment, or was that fun?
I don't know. It seemed to work pretty well. I guess you could say something for guys working together, getting to know each other well, but
mm-hmm.
I didn't see anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that some other units, kept crews together. And I don't know of anything wrong with that either.
Okay.
So I really couldn't tell you. It was just something that was expected. I liked it because I got to know more crew chiefs and more Peter pilots and more aircraft commanders
because
mm-hmm. I'm flying with them,
mm-hmm.
you know, different ones all the time. Anyway, you know, you'd look up your name under what tail number. The tail number was really the serial number of the helicopter. And generally, you just glance to see the other three names who you were flying with.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd go out and report to the helicopter. You'd pick up had our flight helmets. We usually reported with our flight helmets, M16, bandolier of ammo, a little box of maybe one or two C-ration meals, one or two canteens of water.
Mm-hmm.
Generally didn't have an idea what kind of mission you were going to fly until you got to the helicopter and, you know, the aircraft commander would say so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the crew chief generally would have the machine guns mounted by that time. He'd get them from the armory.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have them mounted on, and he'd be doing a pre-flight. And usually the door gunner and the pilot and the aircraft commander would arrive roughly the same time. The pilot, the aircraft commander and the pilots, they went through their quick pre-flight and the like and talked for a couple of minutes over the maps and everything, made sure they had the same maps.
Mm-hmm.
If we were going to operate with any other helicopters, then there'd be radio communications. They'd already know what ships they were operating with, who was in charge of the stick.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot and the AC would be talking back and forth with them. And then we get the signal to start up the helicopter, which is usually put your, let's say, right hand in the air, bent at the elbow with one finger up,
mm-hmm.
and then spin it, show, mm-hmm. start spinning the rotor blades.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the gunner and the crew chief got up on, there's a little step on the top of the back, actually the top and the back skid, where they, the skid went flat along the ground and then curved up
mm-hmm.
like a sleigh at either end. And we, well, actually the gunner first would go back and untie the rope that was holding down the rotor blade so they wouldn't turn in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was usually a rope that had a long piece of metal, maybe 2 feet long, with a hook at the top, and it hooked into a little eye coming off the end of one of the rotors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you took it around and you wrapped this rope attached to this long piece of metal with the hook on it. You wrap it around the stinger on the back of the helicopter, and that kept the rotor blade fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Door gunner was responsible to go back, undo it, bring it around, and you pull down a little bit and then let go quick, and the hook comes up out of the eye and the rotor's free.
Okay.
Then you store the item. And any time we stopped anywhere, it was up to the door gunner to tie down the rotor blade. But then we'd get up on this little step on the rear of the skid,
mm-hmm.
crew chief on the left side, door gunner on the right. And there was a little door that was spring-loaded, and you held it open, like with your thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And what you could do is you could see the engine inside. And this was right behind where the door gunner sat. On the other side, usually I could see a little bit of light because I could see the crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
Was looking in his section. And you did that whenever he was starting the helicopter. And in case you had what was known as a hot start,
mm-hmm.
for some reason a fire occurred, you had to know immediately. And then your job, well, you saw a fire, you had a fire extinguisher available, and you could put it out. At the same time, one of the guys would run up to the front of the ship, you know, and indicate fire.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw that or had that happen, but this is something you always had to do.
Right.
When the helicopter gets up to RPM, you wait until it's fully started, and you can tell it's a certain RPM. It's roughly the same as the RPM, the rate of fire of an M60 machine gun, which is you never forget it because there's that constant vibration in the helicopter, and it's just like always there. So once you see the engine started up, there's no fire. You let the little door close, and on the left side, the crew chief walked up to the theater pilot's door. I walked up to the aircraft commander's door. We took and unlocked and slid forward an armored plate that helped protect the pilots from fire from the right and the left.
Mm-hmm.
Then we took the door, and we closed the door and locked it. And not locked it, but turned the handle down to secure it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got back, and we got in our seats and put our seat belts on. We already had our chicken plates, which were in kind of a cloth vest.
Mm-hmm.
We already had those on. We had our helmets on. And then we plug our helmets into the intercom system within the helicopter.
Okay.
And then we take off and go off to do whatever missions we had to do.
How long would all this take usually?
Oh, not long at all. If it's an emergency,
mm-hmm.
you can do it in 15 minutes.
Okay.
Easily. Normally, you know, like I said, there's a lot of communication. Pilots are finding out where they're going, who they're flying under, how many ships in the stick. What's the call sign of command and control? What's the call sign of the gunships? You know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they're their regular checkoff. Any time that we landed someplace and we're going to stop, like to refuel, the crew chief did the refueling. We would stop, we would land at the POL point, petroleum, oil, and lubrication. And the first thing we did was go forward, open up the doors of the pilot and the co-pilot, unlatch and pull straight back the armored door, the armored plate guarding each one of them. Now, the pilot and the co-pilot would be talking back and forth, but the door gunner's job was to stand up on the plate on top of the front part of the skid. Stand right there at the aircraft commander's side. The filling tank was on the right side. The crew chief would come around. He would take the pump handle, just like the pump handle of the gas station, and he would start filling the ship. The door gunner's job was just to stand there and look at the crew chief and not take his eyes off him at all. Because if a fire were, the helicopter's running while you're filling it. If a fire were to start, you could have a hell of a disaster. So if all of a sudden you saw the crew chief get real upset or some bit of flame or something, the door gunner would reach in with his right hand and just grab the shoulder or the arm of the aircraft commander and yank. The aircraft commander and pilot didn't need any more communication than that. They knew what that meant. That meant get out of the helicopter now. And they were out in a split second.
Do you ever have any problems like that?
No, no. But I do know of some problems like that.
Okay.
Actually, the biggest problem was there'd be several helicopters coming into a place like that, and they'd collide.
Okay.
Mid-air collisions were a hell of a danger. I was almost in it. Once I saw two crews killed close up. It was terrifying to me. Very few people survived mid-air collisions.
Why were they so prevalent, do you think?
Well, you just had so many helicopters, so many things going on. You can get distracted for a second. The most common that I saw, the one I was almost in, I guess a little bit of it was my fault. what it was, and it was similar to this one that I saw close up. I was on the ground. It happened right close to me. We were flying with another ship supplying South Vietnamese troops. This was up in I Corps. And this is along the coast, the flatland. And we were turning to the left. Now, the pilot, you fly one helicopter, then the other helicopter flies close, usually off to your right. And that pilot just watches that helicopter to his front left. And that's how they fly. And Western and American pilots are taught to fly close formation. I always had a hard time with that.
Right.
My feeling was one good air pocket, something like that, and you're going to have a collision. But they did it all the time. And I'm supposed to be, their pilot on the left side is supposed to be just constant eyes on the helicopter, left front. The crew chief, if you're turning to the left, is watching the helicopter to the left. And the door gunner in the helicopter turning to the light, to the right, is watching them. And when you go to straighten out, I mean, you got three people watching, and they don't tell each other, I'm straightening out now. The pilot especially is supposed to have his eyes right on you, and he's supposed to fly just right on the spin of your rotor blade very closely. And we did it constantly. Well, this one particular time, we're making the turn to the left. I happened to glance up towards the front, And I don't know what I was looking at. I was looking at one of the instruments. I could usually see the instrument, see our altitude, see our speed, see our direction, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It just for a second, I took my eyes off the helicopter, looked up, turned back, and while I had looked up, our helicopter had started to straighten out. Well, apparently the crew chief and the pilot on the helicopter to our right had for some reason at the same second taken their eyes off it. So when I looked back, we were straightening out, but they were still going at a left-hand turn. And in that very short period of time, I turned around, and all I saw was just helicopter and rotor blade, no sky.
Mm-hmm.
We were 3,000 feet up. And the helicopter wasn't exactly vertical to us, but was just about. And I started to step onto the button to scream. I could see the door gunner, the crew chief on the other ship, screaming into his mic.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the pilot. His eyes were big, and his mouth was open. And just as I stepped on the button to scream hard left, their ship kind of dropped, went into a bigger angle, and used their rotor blades like a wing,
mm-hmm.
and just slipped right down underneath us. It was a great, quick maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
But it just terrified. I was left with my mouth open and my eyes big.
Mm-hmm.
The pilot and the AC suddenly saw this helicopter slip underneath them through the plexiglass bubbles in the front bottom of the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So what the hell's going on? And I told them, I said, we started to straighten out, and they didn't pick up on it, and they slipped right down underneath us. So there was some angry conversation back and forth between the two helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
I had some blame in that myself. There should have been all three of us watching.
Mm-hmm. Why wasn't there better communication between aircraft? In general?
Well, there usually was.
Okay.
It's just that...
The pilots were in communication with each other.
You're expected to know... Western Air Forces fly in very close formation.
Mm-hmm.
And you fly, just like the Blue Angels, you just keep your eye on one point. If that point turns to the right or the left just a hair, you turn the exact... kind of hair.
Mm-hmm.
You're expected to do that. That's the way they do it.
Okay.
I never did like flying real close together. I figured it increased the chances of a midair. You made a bigger target. But that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And there must have been a good reason for it. So anyway, I saw the same kind of accident after the first cavit transferred down to Phuc Vinh, down at 3rd Corps.
Mm-hmm.
This must have been in November of 68. Two ships were transferring from revetments on one side of the perimeter to revetments on the other side of the perimeter because they were going to rebuild the revetments. Well, I was off flying that day, and I had just gotten out of formation, and I'd been given a detail. And I was walking over towards the detail, and I happened to watch these two ships flying around the perimeter. My God, they weren't more than 500 feet from me.
Mm-hmm.
And they only had an altitude of maybe 75, 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just casually looking at them. I knew that one of them belonged to a crew chief by the name of Gundrum. And that... the second one belonged to a guy I had just met. He was from California, and I'm trying to remember his name. I had just met this guy 2 days before in a little get-together in one of the barracks at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we just hit it off fantastic. And I knew that was his ship. Well, what was happening is the first ship was flying with only three men. Since they were just flying around the perimeter,
mm-hmm.
They were not flying with a door gunner. The second ship had four men on it. Now, operational procedure says you will fly with a full crew. There's a reason for door gunners. Door gunners not only fire the door gun, they let the pilots know if they're clear on their area, on their side.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like automatically if we're turning right, then the door gunner generally just would step on his button and say clear right. If we're turning left, the door gunner will say clear left.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And they should have had a full crew. The same situation, they were turning to the left, and as the lead ship started to straighten out, I was looking at them, and I suddenly stopped walking because I didn't know what it was, but something wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
And then a second later, I realized what it was. The plane of the rotor blades on both choppers were different, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If they were flying in formation, the plane of those rotor blades would be the same. And I realized to my horror that the second ship off to the right, the plane was steeper heading to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally got so close, I knew there was no avoiding. Now, the midair that I almost had, to this day, I really swear the rotor blades intermeshed. In this case, the rotor blades intermeshed and touched. And the rotor blades fell off the ship that turned, the ship on the right that turned into the ship on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And they just fell straight down. And in terror, I watched this guy that I had just met. I watched him jump at the last second.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to help you, really, but what the hell? The main thing is, you know, you might possibly get away with being seriously injured because when that helicopter hits the ground, the whole floor was fuel cell, and it's going to explode in a ball of flame.
Mm-hmm.
You will have no chance whatsoever. If you can land away from the helicopter far enough, you got one chance to 10 million, so it's better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was terrible to watch this guy. And they landed just outside the perimeter wire into an old minefield.
Hmm.
Some with our mines, some with Vietnamese mines, some with some old French mines. It exploded immediately. The second helicopter kind of wobbled and veered and wobbled and veered and wobbled and veered and somehow made it inside the perimeter, hit the ground, bounced into the air, and flipped over on its left side, everybody started running towards it. It didn't explode. I ran towards it. We all knew the danger of explosion, but, mm-hmm. you know, they're our buddies. And I'm running, and this guy's running from every direction, and I happen to notice there's four guys running past me.
Mm-hmm.
In the opposite direction. Well, I get up to the helicopter, and this guy's crawling all over the helicopter looking for the crew, and suddenly dawns on me, well, who are those four guys running in the opposite direction? And they were wearing flight suits.
Mm-hmm.
Flight suits were kind of fatigues that were fire retardant,
mm-hmm.
and helicopter crews wore them. And come to find out, that was the crew in that ship.
They passed you.
Yeah, and nobody even noticed. Everybody was so intent in getting to that helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And then when everybody realized they were gone, then, you know, immediately get away from the ship.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't explode, but it could have.
Right.
But mid-air collisions were always something to worry about.
How far into your tour with the 227 did this happen?
4 months.
Okay.
From that day forward, I have not enjoyed flying. I do not like to fly.
Even today?
Even today.
Okay.
Would I go back up in a Huey? Yes. But I certainly wouldn't do it for a job again.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in that kind of military situation where you take even more chances.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The being shot at. Sometimes you come into such a tight LZ, it's not quite big enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was not unusual at all for the helicopter to act like a lawnmower. And we would literally cut branches with the rotor blades mm-hmm. intentionally to make it big enough to land.
Wow.
And that sounds hair-raising, and it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you can knock down some pretty good-sized branches. Mm-hmm. Usually, you don't want to hit anything more than 4 inches thick.
Mm-hmm.
But we've done it, and you feel that shock go through. If you hit something larger than that, you can be in trouble, real deep trouble.
Right.
But thin branches and the like, done it a lot.
Hmm.
And there were a lot of accidents. You're very vulnerable, hovering down slowly
mm-hmm.
into this small LZ, because the grunts, they've got some engineers with them with some explosives, and everybody else is cutting with machetes.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a grunt, I've helped cut down a tree 8-9 inches in diameter with a machete, and that's a heck of a job. I wouldn't
mm-hmm.
want to do it now, but engineers sometimes would blow down the bigger trees, or a helicopter would lower chainsaws on ropes.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, they were one-ship LZs. And if the enemy wanted, if you got to fly over the LZ, you have to hover above it for a second and then lower yourself slowly down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gives the enemy plenty of time to start firing mortar rounds. And they already know where your LZ is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're within sight and range, they can just fire small arms, machine guns, stuff like that.
Right.
On Hill 875 during my first tour, when I was wounded, we lost 16 helicopters around Hill 875.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a lot of the general accidents. Been in a couple myself.
You want to talk about those?
Yeah. There was one. We had just landed at an engineer position.
Mm-hmm.
And these engineers had tank dozers, which are tanks with a big bulldozer blade on them.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, they had some D-10 bulldozers. And the French had a big trouble in the area known as the Street Without Joy, mm-hmm. Highway 1 and the close-packed villages,
right?
Especially in Quang Tri province. But we decided we weren't going to have that problem. So the people were moved to secure areas, where they could be watched over, and a better, a more efficient way of keeping the communists out who came in to collect the rice tax and take forced labor and recruit volunteers, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we just moved everybody, and then we moved in there with these big bulldozers and everything, and we just flattened it. Just completely flattened it. So this small engineering unit, they had a little fort they'd made with the bulldozers. They pulled up the dirt and a berm and a little square for at night when they weren't working. And they'd guard themselves during the day. They just flattening trees and buildings and stuff like that, little hooches and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So we had landed to, I believe, drop off supplies to a and they were flattening everything, like I said, and for 5 miles in any direction off to one corner of this little berm fort that they had made, there was not one tree except that one off to that one corner. There was no tree for 5 miles in any direction except that one.
Hmm.
And that one was probably 30 feet high.
Okay.
A dead tree. We landed. The pilot took off. I'm looking over to the right. Everything's clear. Crew chief's looking to the left. Everything's clear. And I don't know what the hell's going on up front, but all of a sudden there's a loud crash. And I feel the helicopter kind of stop. The tail rose up. We almost reached the 90-degree position.
Hmm.
in helicopter, in a Huey, if you reach the 90-degree position, you're dead, because you will continue, and there's no way to avoid it, upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And a Huey can't do that. And then we started up almost to the 90-degree position, then all of a sudden the front of the helicopter swung back up,
mm-hmm.
and we started going forward again. And all of a sudden I feel more of a rush of air, and I look forward, I could see that one of the plexiglass bubbles was smashed. I don't remember, it was under the pilot's feet or under the aircraft commander's feet, one of them. And I looked back, and I saw the tree, and I saw a piece of what had been on top of the tree laying on the ground. And I looked forward, and the aircraft commander was turned towards the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And his mouth was going a mile a minute, and there was rage in his eyes. He had his visor up.
Mm-hmm.
He had turned the intercom off, so the crew chief and I couldn't hear.
Mm-hmm.
But the pilot was really getting his rear end chewed real bad, because now they have to explain, how the devil did you hit the only tree for 5 miles in any direction,
right,
going forward? You can't blame the gunner or the crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
It's the aircraft commander. Well, the aircraft commander takes ultimate responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
The pilot is the junior pilot. And even though he did it, he'll get in trouble, but the aircraft commander will too.
Mm-hmm.
Big investigation, all that. But there was another one. We had a typhoon hit, and a lot of the area was flooded.
Mm-hmm.
Camp Evans was on kind of low rolling hill, so we didn't get flooded too bad. But, oh, those poor civilians. The water, I swear, must have been 5 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
And all their homes and the like were flooded out. Well, some of the people used to take advantage of that, and they'd go out in these little boats, and they'd set up these nets, trying to net fish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the ships from our unit, you're not supposed to fly below a certain level. But a lot of times we would, because the lower to the ground you flew, the faster it seemed you were going.
Mm-hmm.
And you also got to look at things, you know, kind of inch better. Well, this one ship, they're breaking the rules, and they're flying like 2 feet off top of the water.
Mm-hmm.
I've done this myself.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where if there's a low rice paddy dike 2 feet high, we had to come up 2 feet to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like hot rodding with
okay.
a bunch of kids, and we all were a bunch of kids. Anyway, they're going along. They see a sampan off to the right and a sampan off to the left. And they didn't think anything about it. They didn't see the fine mesh screen that was attached to two poles near the sampans.
Mm-hmm.
The skids, there was a third sampan on the other side, and they were going to fly right over it. The skids hit the mesh net, and this thing must have been extremely taut.
Mm-hmm.
Because the helicopter flipped right over. I went into the 90-degree position, continued over, landed on top of the sampan with an old man and a little boy in it.
Mm.
And amazingly, all six people survived with no injuries.
Wow.
How the little boy and the old man in the boat would that rotating blade survive with no injuries, I have no idea. But
the helicopter flipped on top of their boat.
Right on top of their boat.
Okay.
This is what I was told, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, and everybody in the crew was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, any time there's anything like that with this damage to the property of the South Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
Civil affairs would come out, and they would be reimbursed.
Okay.
This is, you know. So they were reimbursed for their net, for their sampan, and for, what's that word they used in Baghdad? Awe and whatever.
Shock and awe?
Yeah.
for psychological trauma?
Yeah, it must have been, I'll tell you.
I can imagine.
So,
Now, were you on this bird or not?
No.
Okay.
First thing I knew about it was word went around, the ship went down.
Uh-huh.
And but that everybody was okay. And then I saw a medium-lift helicopter, Chinook, bringing the helicopter in, slung underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was put into a special area in the company position, and these yellow tapes, like they put around a crime investigation scene,
mm-hmm.
were put up, and guards were put on it, because wrapped around the skids of the helicopter was the net.
Okay.
Now, this is gross negligence. You're not supposed to fly that low.
Mm-hmm.
You just almost completely destroyed what cost then stripped down a $250,000 military aircraft,
mm-hmm.
which was also not available for support to the troops. Bottom line was the aircraft commander and the pilot, if the pilot was flying, their careers were over because they endangered everybody, all six people,
mm-hmm.
plus the use of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So that night, that evening, I'd been flying all day, but they told me and another guy, I remember it started raining hard, the remainder of the typhoon, you guys are going to go out and sit inside the cabin of that helicopter and pull guard. Nobody is to approach that helicopter
mm-hmm.
because of any evidence, especially the netting around the skids. So I remember we're sitting in the crushed up cabin, cargo bay, and just talking, and then we took turns sleeping and one guy watching. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of things did happen. We had ships shot down.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't too long after I got there. The first one happened. It was one of those ironic things.
Mm-hmm.
I was flying command and control, which means I had the battalion commander, the battalion artillery officer, the battalion intelligence officer
mm-hmm.
on the ship. And what was going on was a company of American troops was being besieged on this hill halfway between Camp Evans and the Aschau Valley
mm-hmm.
up to the west of Camp Evans. And so we were flying around while they were bringing in airstrikes, and this is about, I don't know, the battle started early. This is about maybe, it went on and on and on. It was a lot of fighting. About noontime, we went back. Another command and control ship took over with the battalion XO and some other guys.
Mm-hmm.
The battalion commander had to look at the situation of the rest of his own battalion. Plus, you take a break after a while. It's cold. Command and control flies at 10,000 feet, and it can be 110 degrees on the ground, but you're going to be shivering at 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we came in to refuel and for us to get some food real quick and then go back out. Like I said, battalion commander gets caught up with what's going on with the rest of his battalion and within his brigade, within division. Right after a real quick lunch, we're getting ready to go out again, and the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Stone, Robert Stone, I think his name was, and another guy who was a crew chief, or a maintenance man,
mm-hmm.
but had been a crew chief, they came up to the door gunner and the crew chief for the ship that day, and the gunner's name was Ney, and I met him last year, and we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they told him that, they told both of them that they were wanted up at operations right away. So Ney says, well, the ship's getting ready to take off. And Sergeant Stone said, well, we'll tell them to wait for you. I said, okay, and they headed off for operations. But what it was you had to fly a certain number of hours per month to
mm-hmm.
get your flight pay.
Right.
And guys who weren't flying all the time liked to fly once in a while. Well, Sergeant Stone was one of the platoon, was one of the door gunner platoon sergeants. And the other guy was used to be a crew chief, was now a maintenance man, but he was qualified, of course, as a crew chief.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they wanted to fly. So Nay tells me, last year when I saw him, he says, we got up and we're just about walking into operations when I hear a ship taking off behind me. I turned around, and it was our ship.
Mm-hmm.
And what the hell's going on? They got into operations, and operations said, no, we didn't change anything. You got to talk to your platoon sergeant about that. Well, platoon sergeant, they went out with the ship. They told the pilot and the aircraft commander that they'd been reassigned, and the other guys got the afternoon off. So Ney and the crew chief were a little annoyed about being, you know, having the wool pulled over their eyes. But what the heck, they got the afternoon off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by that time, command and control of the ship I was on was back out overlooking this hill. Middle of all the mountains. And the fighting had gotten worse and worse and worse, and more North Vietnamese troops were pulling in, and the American forces were starting to run out of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but I think this was B Company 8th Cav. Second Battalion, B Company 2nd Battalion 8th Cav. So they had to get some ammunition in, especially M79 grenade launcher ammunition, grenades, and machine gun ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
So the helicopter couldn't land. The LZ wasn't quite big enough. A tree had been blown by a mortar round that had hit it so that it obscured part of the LZ.
Mm-hmm.
So what they had to do was known as a sling load. And what they did is they have a sling. They put everything in the sling. The helicopter comes up to a hover just over the sling, and a rigger hooks an eye in the sling onto the hook underneath the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And then the helicopter slowly lifts up until it's taut and then takes off. And the idea is to get in real quick, come to a real hover just for a second, and the pilots can push a button or pull a lever, get what it was, and the hook opens and it drops a sling load. And as soon as it touches the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then zoom, they're gone. So we're flying in a left-hand circle, which means that I'm on the right-hand side of the ship. In general, I'm looking up at maybe 15 degrees for, you know, I don't know how many hours. I'm just seeing blue sky. But I can see down a little bit. Very boring. I hated command and control.
Mm-hmm.
As they were coming in, I knew what was going on, so I was able to lean out a little bit. I saw the ship come in. I saw it make its sling load drop. I saw it start to pull out, and then I lost sight of it in all the trees and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sat back. Well, you know, they made the sling drop. And then suddenly, maybe 30 seconds later, we were hooked in to our ship's intercom, plus we were hooked in and could listen but not talk to the battalion net. And the infantry commander on the ground called in saying that the helicopter had just gone down.
Hmm.
It crashed. It had been hit and crashed. And that changed everything suddenly. I remember looking again. I could not see the helicopter at all.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's very excited. Battalion commander ordered the company commander, you got to send out a squad to fight their way down there to that helicopter. But for some reason, the North Vietnamese on that side of the hill did not oppose them at all. This squad was able to just run right down off the hill.
Mm-hmm.
in an attack formation and made it down to the helicopter. The helicopter had not exploded, but the pilot and the aircraft commander were killed on impact. Sergeant Stone, the platoon sergeant who had him and the crew chief had fooled those two guys so they could fly, he had been flying on the right-hand side as a gunner. And if the helicopter lands hard on the right-hand side,
mm-hmm.
the engines are between the gunner and the crew chief in the back of the ship. if it lands real hard, the engines can break the engine mount bolts and come crashing through on the side that you land hard on,
mm-hmm.
and crush either the door gunner or the crew chief, and this is what happened to Sergeant Stone. They found the crew chief alive and apparently unhurt. The only thing wrong that they could see was he was drenched in JP-4, which was the fuel that we used in the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
So they radioed Foe up that three were dead. They had one who was okay. So they were told, leave the bodies, because they were afraid that the North Vietnamese would pinch off this one squad
mm-hmm.
and keep them from getting back in. The main thing was get any survivors and get the maps and shoot the radios.
Mm-hmm.
Because anytime you had to grab your maps, if you could, and then you had two radios, two FM radios, and if at all possible, you put a bullet through each one so the North Vietnamese can't use the radios.
Mm-hmm.
And those are your top priorities. So they did that. They got to the top of the hill. They just took a few rounds as the North Vietnamese were starting to come in. The North Vietnamese were starting to realize what had happened, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to pinch them off. And we got the word they were starting to the top of the hill with the survivor. And the next word we got is they had reached the perimeter. They were inside the perimeter, and the survivor was dead. And we were totally confused because we knew they hadn't taken that much fire.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, what I heard was that what had killed the man was that he had been so completely drenched with this JP-4, which is a sort of a jet fuel, a real
mm-hmm.
high-octane gasoline, that it had gone in through his pores, and they had also swallowed some and breathed in a lot of the fumes, and that's what killed him. Because one of the grunts ended up coming to C Company
mm-hmm.
as a door gunner, and he told us this, and he said, you know, we couldn't believe it. The guy was all right. The word we got, and when the guys come into the perimeter with him, they were half dragging him, and then he just died.
Well,
Now, this person that reported this to us ended up becoming my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, we still communicate. I finally found him 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Rod Darnell.
Okay.
But it was the damnedest thing. And it was kind of ironic because the crew chief and the door gunner weren't supposed to be on that helicopter.
Right.
So.
What did Ney say about this?
Yeah, he said, if I'd been there, I'd have been dead.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a mind blower.
Yeah. Tell me what the typical maintenance problems you had on the helicopters.
The only real maintenance problem I seem to remember having is something that happened a few times to people, and it was called a compressor stall.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew it happened when there was a sudden loud bang, and the ship jerked. And there was a real danger to it. It's like a piston misfiring, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And the real danger is that it'll create such a shock to the transmission that you'll lose the tail rotor, the transmission going back to the tail rotor from the engine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the engine runs the main rotor plus the tail rotor. But that tail rotor shaft will break. Now, a helicopter needs a tail rotor, except some of the new modern ones. Generally, they need a tail rotor in order to keep the helicopter from rotating with the rotor blades,
mm-hmm.
with the torque of the rotor blades. You see, if you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The rotor blades are going in one direction. The body will tend to go in that direction, too. If you're going less than 60 knots, you need that tail rotor to blow air to keep the body in line, because it blows air left or right, usually left. It's called giving it more left pedal, is when the ship starts to go with the rotor blades. You give it more left pedal, and air blows to the left, and it brings it back into line again. going over 60 knots, then the airstream going by the helicopter will automatically, with that tail rudder coming up, keep the body in line. So you don't need a tail rotor if you're going over 60 knots.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going under 60 knots and you lose the tail rotor, the ship will begin to turn with the rotor blades. You'll lose all lift and you'll drop like a rock.
Okay.
So that was a real big danger there.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to me once. We were coming down off this mountain position that a company had set up on for the day. And we'd been there twice before delivering their resupply.
Mm-hmm.
And we lifted up, and it was a real steep mountain, all heavily. What we would do is we would kind of get up, go over to the side of the mountain, and then they'd kind of use that rotor blade as a wing again. And maybe 50 feet above the trees, it was extremely steep, down into a real deep valley.
Mm-hmm.
We'd just kind of zip, fly, wing-like, about 50 feet above the trees, down into this valley.
Mm-hmm.
By flying, you flew close to the trees, if there was any aircraft fire in the area, and there had been some early, because the lower down you are, the more hidden you are, and the enemy can't see you through the trees. And then flying also like that, you very quickly got out of the area. So it was probably about the third time we came off that hill. We just started down, and there was this loud bang, and I felt a jerk. And I heard the pilot talking to the crew chief. He was very upset. He said, "What do you think, chief? Was that a compressor stall?" And the crew chief said, "Yeah, I think it was. We got to get back to base right away." I've heard of them before.
Mm-hmm.
As far as maintenance, surprisingly, a lot of crew chiefs had no formal training at all. It was just OJT.
Hmm.
The maintenance people would do a maintenance check
every
certain few hours, and the crew chief checked the oil and washed the windshield and, you know, a few other things.
Right.
And I was stunned.
Right.
You'd expect the crew chief to be as well trained as a car mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And some were. But sometimes we were short, and some guys were just appointed crew chief. Usually guys who had had experience already as door gunners.
Mm-hmm.
But that really blew my mind at times. We used to help with maintenance crews. Sometimes we'd change a rotor blade or things like that if we were off flight duty that day.
Mm-hmm. So when you finished your 6 months with the 227th, you probably could have become a crew chief. You were qualified to become a crew chief.
Yeah, my friend Rod did.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was kind of scared at first. He told me that because I didn't know they were doing that.
Right.
Either that or it didn't happen. We didn't run so short of crew chiefs. But I've heard of it since.
Hmm. Yeah,
so that was funny.
Tell me about your door gun and the weapons you carried.
The weapon we fired was the aviation model of the M60 machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same machine gun that the infantry used. And the numerical designation of the aviation model was the M60D. And its difference was that instead of a stock on the end, stock had been taken off, and two handles, like a 50 caliber machine gun, had been put on. And right in front of both of the handles, you'd hold the handles, and right in front there were two triggers, one on each side. You had both hands on the handles, and there were two triggers. All you had to do was pull one, and the weapon would fire. But they had two on there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you'd have to lean way out to the rear. Fire straight, but you had limits to keep the gun from shooting off your rotor blades or your tail rotor or shooting the pilots or anything.
Right.
But sometimes you get so far out aiming down, you could only use one arm. Or if you wanted, sometimes pilots would have the crew chief and the door gunner bring their gun up to level where it kind of stops so it can't shoot any higher and shoot the rotor blade.
Mm-hmm.
And then aim it straightforward as far as it would go, which was exactly parallel to the helicopter. And then the helicopter could make a dive on a target and tell the gunners just hold down the trigger, and then the pilot would adjust the fire by adjusting the direction of the helicopter.
Right.
We only did that a couple of times, and you only do that in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why you'd have two triggers.
Okay.
It was a reliable weapon. I always liked the M60 machine gun. Sometimes the bipod would be on it that the infantry used, but most of the time it wouldn't. If you were shot down and you had to defend yourself with that weapon with the bipod and the two grips on the back, it would be very hard to use, I should think.
Mm-hmm.
Then it had on top a flip-up anti-aircraft sight, which was a big X with a big cross with a circle in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And that was used mainly, if you're going to fire at a target, just to initially get you into the area of the target, okay? Same thing with a regular machine gun. You use the sights just to get into the area of the target, and then you start firing, and then you look up over the sights, and you're watching where the tracers, which is one round out of five, are going, and where you're actually hitting. You don't use the sights any longer.
Right.
But
how long did it take you to get used to firing accurately with the M60D?
It was a very mounted on that pedestal, very heavily mounted. It was easy to fire and easy to be accurate.
Okay.
I never had any problem with the M60 even in the grunt model.
Mm-hmm.
One good thing was we had a huge can, and we'd carry up to 2,500 rounds of gun ammo. That's an awful lot of ammunition.
Yes, sir.
And you didn't have to carry it on your back. It was already mounted on a ship. And then it fed out, and they never had developed a good mechanism for making sure that the bullets went into the gun nice and even. And when I was a grunt, when I was a door gunner, we always ended up using a certain size C-ration can that just somehow clicked perfectly onto the side of the machine gun and fed the bullets in perfectly.
That's interesting.
Why the Army hadn't come up with something, I don't know.
Right.
I noticed that the Blackhawk helicopters today in use in Afghanistan and Iraq use the exact same machine gun, and I can't see much of a difference in them. So that's how reliable the weapon was.
Okay. Did you carry like a personal weapon, a .45 or anything like that?
We were authorized to carry, pilots were authorized to carry pistols.
Mm-hmm.
We could carry one if we wanted, but that kind of went back and forth. I think that company commander just kind of, if you want to carry a pistol, go ahead.
Right.
What they offered were .45s or Smith & Wesson or... Colt 38s.
Mm-hmm.
38s weren't worth too much. I just always took my rifle and one or two bandoliers of ammo. We also had a little box attached to the side of the compartment, and inside we'd have smoke grenades for marking targets and the like. We also had regular hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we'd see something and we'd fly over it and drop a grenade on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was about it.
Okay.
What
kind of rules of engagement did you have as the door gunner? Did they vary from mission to mission, or were you kind of given, here's what you can and can't do in general?
Well, you can't kill civilians.
Right.
Anybody carrying a weapon, even if they're dressed as a civilian, but they're carrying an AK-47, they're fair game.
Okay.
There are areas that were free fire zones. Now, a free fire zone, and you hear about this, doesn't mean that you get to kill anything you want in that zone. If there's an old lady and three or four kids in a free fire zone, you don't get to or are not required to gun them down. It just means that it's an area where there are no civilians living,
mm-hmm.
there aren't supposed to be any, and you don't need to call in and get permission to fire at them. You can fire back at somebody that's shooting at you no matter where if you
right.
can identify the target, but it just meant that there was supposed to be no civilians in the area. Well, there could also be your own troops in the area, too. You always identified your target.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was an enemy soldier, it was fair game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the rules of engagement. I mean, if an enemy soldier, if you flew up on one suddenly,
mm-hmm.
and he turned around and threw his arms up in the air, you had the option. It could be an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take prisoners, so you might just fly around him. And if he tries to move left or right, put some rounds in front of him, you know, to stop and give him the message, stay where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe try and call in a couple of other ships, gunships or something, to cover you while you'd land and take him prisoner.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever do that?
No. Personally, myself, no. Others,
okay.
yes.
Okay.
But usually, if they hear you're coming or something, they're going to run.
Right.
And if they got a weapon, then you just plain shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't have a weapon and they're dressed as a peasant, and you know that you're not too far from the edge of a free fire zone,
mm-hmm.
you might want to hold your fire. But if they start running, then that's guilt right there.
Right. Did you witness or hear of any abuse of these rules of engagement?
Once.
Okay.
We had a avionics, which is your communication system within the helicopter
mm-hmm.
guy. I'd always liked him. And they used to like to get some door gunner time in, too. We went out to make an assault in a rice paddy area between two villages. It was not a free fire zone. We came in. I was about fifth ship back in a stick of six. You come in first wave, and you're really, I mean, your fingers are really on the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
You're always nervous, especially in the first one. And the front of the stick had come in over this one village, where they were landing between these two villages in rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in my seat, looking around. I got the gun, my fingers are on the triggers. And all of a sudden, I hear bap, 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 bap. And it's like when everybody's on edge and you're something like that, one person fires, everybody just starts to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole bunch of us just pull the trigger for maybe 10, 15 rounds before we realize, whoa, Jesus, we're over a village.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't hear any incoming fire. Just an M60 that fired about 10, 15 rounds. And so I stopped, and I'm looking for targets, and I'm looking for targets, and I don't see anything. And as we come down and land, I look forward just a little bit, and here's a dead Vietnamese man laying along the side of a rice paddy dike. The grunts jump off the helicopter, and we take off right away. The rice paddies are wet. They're actively being grown. And I had no idea what happened. I assumed, you know, he had a weapon or something, and we just happened to land when he was crossing between, over the dikes, between the two villages.
Mm-hmm.
Well, later on that night, we had a get-together in one of the tents, and this guy, and I won't name names, this guy had been drinking a little bit, and he's laughing and boasting about this guy that he shot earlier in the day during that CA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the corner, and I'm listening. I'm, you know, interested what happened. I come to find out the guy did not have a weapon at all. He was walking along this dike. All of a sudden, here comes these six helicopters, and they land just about right next to him. They start landing. And he's just standing there totally surprised, and this guy just gunned him down. And I remember being just so totally shocked because I didn't expect it from this person. Secondly, I mean, you had, you know, six, seven infantrymen on a helicopter you're landing.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to take the guy prisoner. They're going to check his ID. If he doesn't have any ID, he's going to be taken prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
For all that guy knows, he could have been an Arvin soldier on leave. And I remember from that day on, I just did not like this guy. About half the guys there were drunk, and you know, at this little get together, and they were laughing. The other half just didn't express any emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard a couple of comments after that. You know, shouldn't have done that.
Right.
And I was really disappointed because I had liked the guy a lot
mm-hmm.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, you have current time in civilian life, and you have it in wartime, too. Certainly read about it enough to know the wars.
Mm-hmm.
And, we obviously didn't make any friends in that incident.
Right.
But generally, I don't think it left very much of an impression. Good impression of people.
Okay. You want to take a break for today?
Yeah.
Okay. This is Richard Barone, and I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Today is May 23rd, 2003. It's 8:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the interview room at the Special Collections Library, and Mr. Roy is in Jaffrey, New Hampshire. Sir, let's pick up with, we'll continue talking about your second tour, and let's talk about your SOG, your SOG support activities.
The Special Operations Group, MACV Special Operations Group, generally didn't have their own helicopter units supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I believe they did. But at the time I was with the CAV, and this was, they were doing this at least from the beginning of 1968, possibly earlier. But this is the summer of 68
mm-hmm.
when I was with them. The local aviation units supporting the larger combat units supplied the airlift capabilities for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten up one morning to report for, you know, regular missions. I reported up to the operations center to find out what ship I was being attached to.
Mm-hmm.
The crew chief, the pilot, and the assistant pilot. And I saw SOG in the comment column, and I asked the sergeant on duty what that was, and he remembered that I was still relatively new. I'd been with the unit for maybe a month and a half. And hadn't heard anybody really talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
He took me over to the operations officer, and he sat me down, and he read me from a prepared sheet that the mission I was going on was top secret. I forget what level it was, but it was high. It was not the highest, but it was high.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was not to talk about it with anybody for 10 years after that date.
Okay.
If I did, I would be subject to up to 10 years imprisonment. Or if I talked about it to the enemy, of course, that would be treason.
Right.
And then I had to sign the paper saying I wouldn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I had already known. A lot of people knew we were flying reconnaissance missions into Laos and Cambodia and North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the first time I had actually come up and faced them. So I reported out to the ship, and crew chief was doing the maintenance. The pilot and the co-pilot were going over the maps, and they were telling me about, okay, we're going to fly these special forces units.
Mm-hmm.
Um, they weren't part of 5th Special Forces. They worked for MAC, VS, or G, but they very closely were interlinked with Special Forces. Mm-hmm. Special Forces also had its own kind of missions going on.
Right.
So they told me, basically, it was that we would be inserting and extracting small reconnaissance teams into Laos, mm-hmm. that our unit was allowed to go into Laos and Cambodia, but not into North Vietnam. That was run by a completely different group, because it was far more dangerous. And they had their own helicopter support and gunship support.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it was that day we were going to go in and pick up a team that had been inside of Laos. They hadn't been spotted. They were aware of and the like.
Mm-hmm.
They told me about the dangers involved. They told me that there'd be three helicopters, three Hueys,
mm-hmm.
the regular Slicks, we call them, you know, the regular mm-hmm. Helicopter with a machine gun on either side and a door gun and a crew chief, the mm-hmm. utility troop carrier supply ship.
Did you find that that was a normal complement of Slicks for such
yes.
type, these type
yes,
missions?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And there was a reason for it. And that there'd be a command and control helicopter flying up high.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a forward observer in a forward observer aircraft. Earlier in the war, that had been like a little Piper Cub, mm-hmm. and they came out with more sophisticated types, the O-1, the OV-1, and the OV-10.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be two gunships with us. So I said, okay. So we flew up to a special forces camp. A lot of times these missions were staged out of special forces camps that were along the border. And this special forces camp was called Milok.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, southwest, just down the hill from the large Marine base called Camp Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
And this little special forces camp was extremely well defended. I was very impressed when I flew in and saw they had ground-mounted miniguns on the corners and the amount of barbed wire. But there were a lot of secret things going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
So we went in and we shut down. The pilots went in and talked to the SOG people to get more information and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew chief and I were out at the ship just doing some minor maintenance and everything. And a couple of the guys from SOG came over and said that, you know, that they were part of the liaison team in the command and control helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And they told us pretty well, you know, well, we go in here all the time. This time it's going to be over about 20 miles, I believe it was about 20 miles south of Saipon
mm-hmm.
in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
To be ready to meet just about anything. It was a very heavily defended area. Saipon was a very important crossroads
mm-hmm.
area in Laos, just across the border.
Mm-hmm.
So actually we hung around for about an hour and a half. The mission was due to go in, you know, to pick them up at a very certain time. The forward observer would go ahead first and would make radio contact, but he wouldn't fly over them. He'd be flying, you know, 3 or 4 miles north, south, east,
mm-hmm.
west.
Right.
So he wouldn't pinpoint anything. He just looked like a regular forward observer out looking for targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure that, you know, things were okay. And we were constantly receiving intelligence information. So finally, everybody come out. Command and control got into their ship. We got into ours. And in the 227th, we used a call sign.
Mm-hmm.
With the first ship being called Yellow 1,
mm-hmm.
the second ship Yellow 2, the third ship Yellow 3, and on and on and on. In this case, there were three ships.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Yellow 1. Now, the reason there were three ships, one ship could pull this team out. But if the first ship went in and had to abort or were shot down, the second ship, Yellow 2, would then come in.
Mm-hmm.
The gunships would begin giving support. The forward observer would, if they were within artillery range, which they usually weren't,
mm-hmm.
would be calling in either more helicopter gunships or tactical air support, which were usually about 30,000 feet up, just doing barrel rolls and loop-de-loops,
mm-hmm.
waiting for a call. At that height, you can't see them or hear them. But they were that's called on station. On call means you might have to wait 10, 15 minutes for them. But for missions like this, they were usually on station.
Okay.
So we went in, and there's no real marking for the border at all. I could just tell that, you know, it was the southern end of the Quezon Valley. The Ashau Valley I could see off to the south, and I knew both mountain ranges on the west side of it, so I got a rough idea when we crossed the border.
Mm-hmm.
We flew at about 3,000 feet. Anybody could have seen us. But that's the best way to make speed and get there.
Mm-hmm.
We made some turns left and right and the like. We didn't fly absolutely straight. As we started to approach the point where we're going to pick them up, we started getting lower and lower and then making more turns and the like. Again, so if you passed over a spotter or any enemy unit, you're going one direction 1 minute, and then, you know, you're going another direction another minute.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly we turned, and we went in, well, Yellow 2 and Yellow 3 kind of went off to one side, and we flared on top of this little hill, and out of the bushes comes two North Vietnamese soldiers.
Hmm.
And I was stunned, and I moved the gun over, getting ready to fire,
mm-hmm.
and there would have been no missing. And all of a sudden, a hand, on our ship, we also had a liaison person, one person.
What do you mean a liaison person? Who was...
From SOG.
From SOG, okay.
Right. And he came over and he pushed the front of my weapon aside.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember glancing at him, surprised, and he said he signaled no with his hand, and he signaled his thumb toward himself, like, and he mouthed the word ours.
Okay.
And I looked back, and I was stunned. I mean, these are regular North Vietnamese that I'd been seeing for, you know. And then the third person was an American.
Okay.
And I believe there were two Americans, two North Vietnamese, a South Vietnamese, and a Laotian.
Mm-hmm.
And they all jumped on the ship real quick, and boom, we were gone. I was a little annoyed because nobody had told me to expect a possibly fully uniformed North Vietnamese soldier to come out of the bush.
Right.
And I bitched about that because if that man hadn't reacted quick enough, I'd have killed both of them.
Right.
And possibly the American in the bush behind him.
Mm-hmm.
And I let it be known I was annoyed about that. And SOG apologized,
mm-hmm.
the captain back at Mi Loc.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, we kind of fucked up there.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't even tell the pilots that. But what happened was, you know, a lot of times they'll have Laotians or they'll have Montagnards, but there were a lot of North Vietnamese that surrendered and turned coat.
Mm-hmm.
And these people were checked out extremely closely to make sure they wouldn't be double agents.
Mm-hmm.
And usually we had methods of finding out what their background was in North Vietnam and why they were willing to turn on their comrades.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times it was that, you know, their family was being treated bad. These were, you know, for a lot of interrogation, they realized these were open-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
People have thought for themselves rather than just, you know, the propaganda. But there were some times I've read about where a few of them surrendered, got all the full training on our methods, and then on their first mission just broke away from the group and they were never seen again.
Right.
That, of course, was a disaster. Because a lot of the methods and the like, you know, they wanted to keep secret.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, these people had a good reason. The South Vietnamese were people that had their families killed, intimidated that by Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese. Laotian, same thing, mm-hmm. or the Montagnards, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, usually two. Sometimes that would vary. Sometimes three Americans and three Asians. Sometimes four Americans and two Asians. And not all of them were, not all the time were the Asians dressed as North Vietnamese.
Right.
There were certain missions over there that were run solely by North Vietnamese turncoats, inserted, and had the latest paperwork with the latest signatures, you know, gathered from intelligence information, and would just walk down the trail and pretending to be going someplace and meet up with other North Vietnamese units
mm-hmm.
and just sit around and gossip
mm-hmm.
and pick up intelligence information. That took a lot of courage.
Absolutely.
Because if they were captured, you know.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, after torture, they'd be shot.
What kind of interaction did you witness between these North Vietnamese defectors and the South Vietnamese forces or the Lao, the friendly Lao?
Oh, it's a combat situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just like black and white and Latino and American units, everybody's tight.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys had to be even more so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the mission is just so damn dangerous. They were armed to the teeth. And a lot of occasions where the North Vietnamese, large North Vietnamese units found them, their firepower was just so tremendous. They were able to hold these large units off until a special South Vietnamese Ranger task force or relief force, usually a platoon, company, or battalion if needed,
mm-hmm.
Was inserted. They were incredible. They had very special weapons, too.
Do you remember what they had?
They had mini grenades. They had special knives. They had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We flew back, and we were told to hang around for a while, that there was an insertion going on someplace else, and that if something went wrong, it'd be nice to have us as a backup. So, yeah, we were assigned to them for the whole day anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing went wrong, so we ended up just sitting around bullshitting with different people and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I think about, we had to make one ship a day available to these people. In some units, it was always the same crews and same ships. So they got to know what kind of mission to expect, what to expect from the SOG people, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In the cab, it wasn't that way. It was just one ship would be assigned.
Right.
Now, I had the mission four times, that's all.
Okay.
And that was probably the average. Another mission I was on, we left from Milok again, got over Khe San itself, and this was about 5 months after the siege, and the enemy had left the area, so the base was abandoned. There were just small enemy units around, so there were just small Marine units around.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember noticing that, you know, the mountains just to the north of it and the like would just look like the moon,
mm-hmm.
the bombing that had been going on. And just before we got to the area, I could see the old Army Special Forces camp of Lang Vi, which was overrun during the Battle of Khe San.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the ships turned around, and we went headed back towards Milok. I asked what was going on over the intercom, and he said that they had picked up intelligence that the enemy knew we were coming through radio intercept or whatever, I don't know. As it turned out, through reading later on, all those missions had to be cleared to the South Vietnamese president
mm-hmm.
and some of his aides. But come to find out, one of his aides was a North Vietnamese mole.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized after, the Americans realized after a few of these missions, we come in and they were just sitting right there waiting for him. That something was wrong. So what they did was they, instead of sending the actual time and place, they'd send disinformation mm-hmm. to the South Vietnamese government.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the person who was the mole couldn't complain about it or give himself away.
Right.
So, you know, we'd say it was happening 20 miles over there or 5 miles over there, kilometers, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that, like I said, about four times.
Were they mainly insertion or extraction, or were they extraction?
Both insertion and extraction.
Okay. Can you describe what the SOG personnel were like? What was their attitude, their personality?
A bunch of cowboys.
Yeah?
They were given a lot of freedom.
Uh-huh.
The North Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, and Montagnards, highly trained, everybody, given a much higher pay rate, of course, for a much more dangerous job.
Mm-hmm.
Down at the large base at Phu Bai, part of which later became the base camp for the 101st, Phu Bai was a huge logistics base, helicopter maintenance base, all kinds of things, Army Security Agency base, and I couldn't help but notice that inside the perimeter of this huge camp, which must have been, 8 miles across and 10 miles long, both the ASA section and the SOG section were themselves fortified inside the main fortification. And I mean, they were fortified, because both of those, being very dangerous to the North Vietnamese, they knew would be targets for any kind of sapper attack that was able to break through the outer perimeter. And they were extremely fortified. I don't think they could have fought their way into either one of those two small posts inside the main post. They had the best of the food. And everything, like I said, they had the newest weapons, the special weapons, a very gung-ho attitude, and they had they were very, very, very tough people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was impressed with them.
To your knowledge, were they drawn from different branches of the American service, or did they come all from the Army or from the Marine Corps?
No, they were Army.
Okay.
At that time, these were all Army.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what the Marines must have had something going. I really couldn't tell you. Noel Morrell might be able to tell you about that.
Okay.
But these missions going into Laos and Cambodia, like I said, it was generally known we were doing something like that, and we would have been disappointed if we weren't. You've got to know, you know, who's there, who's coming down the trail, how well are they being, you know, resupplied. You had to know. They're also looking for targets to call in airstrikes on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of little dirty tricks played. But I wouldn't have, I don't think I would have done it. long range reconnaissance patrol inside Vietnam possibly, but, these operations, which were known of as over the fence operations, they were for somebody else. We did also work with LERPs from the 101st, and then there were some special forces kind of operations, special forces units that did kind of different things, and we helped them with LERPs. Many times I inserted LERPs or picked them up and the like.
How different were they from the SOG as far as attitude, personnel?
Oh, top quality.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done the same mission.
Okay.
Of course, both units, the key generally was not to make contact. You don't want the enemy to know that you're there and what you're finding out.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, SOG did some special attacks on some special areas, and I believe it was SOG that did the raid on that prisoner of war camp at Sante, or the men were drawn from those ranks. But the LERPs were very good. They weren't allowed to wear the same any carry any kind of weapon or uses special weapons and the like that SOG had.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember seeing LERPs being pulled out from an area in Dock Tow once when I was at 173rd during the Battle of Dock Tow. We were at Dock Tow 2, mm-hmm. also known as Ben Hat. And somebody pointed up at the sky, and I looked up, and here's three helicopters, and each one has two guys suspended about 50 to 70 feet below them on ropes. They were coming out by that type of extraction. There must have been no place to land.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a couple of those myself during when I was with the Cav.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of nerve-wracking because you have to drop the rope with a weight on it, a penetrator, to get through the trees,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to hover
right.
and wait for the person to get into this little harness-like at the bottom, and then you have to come up very slowly. You can't go forward.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the gunner and a crew chief have to be watching to make sure the guy doesn't get tangled in trees and like. Once they clear the trees, you know, then we can start going forward. But, of course, you're a big target.
Mm-hmm.
While you're doing this, and then you can't fly real fast. What I did notice was, and I didn't find out until later on, is that they'd put their arms and their legs out, kind of like spread eagle position,
mm-hmm.
and that kept them from spinning.
Okay.
I can remember looking down, you know, thinking, my God, down to the end of this rope, and here we are up 3,000 feet or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one would better hope that rope's in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you know, we just insert them in a very, very small LZ. We'd make false insertions. We'd go in, land at a little opening, and just barely touch down and pick up, but nobody would get on or off.
Mm-hmm.
And then go to another place, then another place. And somewhere, randomly, you know, we'd make our drop-off or our pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And this way the enemy kept the enemy confused.
Right.
You know. One time we had dropped off some LERPs out in the mountains behind Camp Evans.
Mm-hmm.
We came in, we dropped them off. They ran off into a little copse of trees we picked off. We picked up and took off. And generally, after you drop somebody off, and this applied for the SOG people too, you'd go away maybe 5 kilometers, and you'd circle for a period of time, maybe 10, 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
just to make sure everything was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing LERPs or SOG would do is they'd go in and they'd go right to ground. And as soon as the helicopters were out and it's quiet, then they'd just sit there and listen for about 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear anything, then they'd start moving. And if anything was going to happen, it would happen as soon as they landed, as soon as after the ships had taken off, or when they started to move off the LZ.
Mm-hmm.
So once we got the word that, yeah, everything seems okay, we're moving off the LZ, then we were released back to other missions.
Okay.
But one time we'd done this, we'd gone off, we were circling, and suddenly got the word that they ran into a North Vietnamese unit.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an ambush. It just so happens that where we that copse of trees they ran off into, there was probably a squad or platoon of North Vietnamese there.
Mm-hmm.
Purely accidental.
Right.
We turned around. We came in real quick. They came running back out the trail. And I remember the last man was a grenadier, and he kept turning towards the copse of trees and firing around now and then. I aimed at the trail that went into the copse of trees, but I didn't see anything. So I didn't fire. I probably should have fired.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm waiting to see a target. But I didn't see anything. He jumped onto the ship and boom, we were gone.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it was just one of those accidental run-ins.
Right.
It wasn't an ambush or anything. I'm sure the North Vietnamese were totally stunned to have this helicopter pop in out of the sky next to where they were sitting.
Mm-hmm.
But that's I don't remember any disasters happening with SOG while I was with the cab.
Okay.
Everything seemed to go fine.
Okay. Now, what about the rest of your second tour? Why don't we pick up and talk about that? Or was that pretty much what your second tour was, working with SOG and then...
Mainly flying missions, ferrying troops here and there, resupply. Occasionally there would be little things. There was one mission we did for SOG. That's right. It was in the Eshel Valley. We were called in to take a small group of men and drop them off in the middle of the Eshel Valley. Wasn't quite sure what was going on. We took them out. We landed real quick. They got off the ship real quick, and we took off real quick. And when they went in, they had boxes, ammunition boxes with them. And they took off for a clump of bushes, I remember. The area was some open area, trees and bushes, stuff like that. And about 20 minutes later, we were called back in again. We came back in, and pickup and takeoff with units like this, it's just you come in, the back of the skids touch the ground, you rock forward until the back of the skids are off the ground, and it's just the front end of the skids on the ground. It's a real quick kind of thing. And when they came back, they didn't have the boxes. Well, when we got back to Fubai, to their main compound pack there, we found out it was one of the Dirty Tricks missions where one of their recon patrols or some recon patrol had found an enemy ammunition cache. Well, what we used to do on and off, or what they used to do, was that they'd sneak in, pick up some of the ammunition, take it back to the rear, booby trap it, and or make it dangerous. Like for rifle bullets, they'd take off the head, they'd pour out the powder, and they'd fill it with C4 explosive and put the head back on. Well, that's too much power for a rifle bullet.
Right.
And the weapon will blow up in the soldier's face. The big things they really wanted were like mortar rounds, especially mortar rounds, because what they would do is attach the firing detonator that when they drop the mortar round down, it sets off the charges that send the mortar round out, and they'd attach that directly to the detonator of the warhead. So as soon as that thing hit the bottom of the mortar tube, it would explode right there, and you get several benefits. You get the benefit of destroying the enemy mortar, wounding or possibly killing the crew, and undermining their morale in the face of their ammunition.
Right.
Destroying the tube is most important, because all the mortar ammunition in the world is worthless unless you have something to fire it with. So that's what they were doing there. I also remember one day we came in from Milok, came back and they asked us to dump, oh God, it must have been 20 boxes of recoilless rifle ammunition, enemy recoilless rifle ammunition. They asked us to dump them into the ocean. Yeah, sure, okay. So we flew out about 5 kilometers out over the ocean, and the crew chief and I just threw off one box at a time. Had a lot of fun watching that box fall 3,000 feet, trying to judge when it was going to hit the water. I'm sure we shook up some fish. But it was one of those little odd missions. Did I go into our transfer down south with the first calf?
No, you did not.
Okay. Along about November 68, First Cav Division was transferred down to the area west of Saigon to help control the approaches down there. So I was picked to be in one of the lead elements that went by ship. And these were basically support vehicles and the like that they'd rather take by ship. It was more economical and the like. So I was like a co-driver with this guy, and we had a gasoline truck and a small water trailer on the back. The gasoline was drained out. Water was put into the gasoline truck because we knew we were going to be in convoy, and they really didn't want us hauling any gasoline. So that evening, they were starting to pack up all over, but again, we were the lead element, forward element. And we drove off to the port at Hue, and I forget what the name of that place was. But we were put on a landing craft, and we were taken out to a ship where the bow of the ship lowers down, and the ship takes on some water inside tanks that lowers the whole ship down into the water. And right up to, so that the bow of the ship is down and water is inside the ship, right up towards the rear. So the landing craft would come in until they ran out of water to lower the ramp, and then the vehicles would get off. The landing craft would back up, and then they'd pump out a little bit of water.
Right.
Gradually, you know, I mean, more and more space would be water-free. The landing craft wouldn't come in as far, and that's how they filled the ship up. So we got the ship, took about 2 hours to completely load the ship, and they were all first cab vehicles, and we were assigned a bunk area, and I was real impressed with the Navy. Those people eat very, very well. Their mess halls are open 24 hours a day. You want a snack, you want a meal. We weren't given very cramped quarters. It was nice quarters. A bunk area. And we were allowed to go up on deck, and I remember, being up on deck, and especially up towards the bow. I'd never been on a big ship before, and it was fascinating. You know, it was for about 4 days it took us to go from Hue down to where you start up the Mekong River at Bung Tao. And once that happened, then we were all forbidden to be up on deck. And the sailors up on deck all manned the 40-millimeter and 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun that could also be used for ground targets. But we had to stay off deck down below, which disappointed me a little bit.
Right.
I was able to get into a porthole, I remember, and take a couple of pictures out of the porthole. And we arrived at Saigon Docks, and we unloaded the opposite of the way we loaded, and we were sent to an assembly area. And that night, Saigon itself took the largest rocket attack of the war. And I didn't know it. I heard some explosions and the like, but we were on the outskirts of the city. So the next day we started on convoy up Highway, I believe it was 13, which used to be known as Thunder Road. And it headed over towards Cambodia, I believe it continued out into Cambodia. But I remember, I believe, going through Lai Ke, possibly Chu Lai, and then up to An Lok, where there was a major battle fought after we had pulled our troops out, but we still gave them air support, and to a place called Quan Loi. And Quan Loi was situated inside of a rubber plantation and had an airstrip hacked out of the rubber trees. And never been in a rubber tree plantation before. All the trees are dressed right and covered down. No matter which way you look, everything's going in a straight row. The plantation owner still lived there, was paid by the Americans for the right to use a major part of his property, and in return, most likely paid taxes to the communists to keep from getting in trouble.
Was this a South Vietnamese gentleman, or was this a...
No, he was Frenchman.
French, that's what I thought.
I'd seen the same thing once during the 173rd at a tea plantation up in Plate Phu. He had a mansion right there on the base, in the middle of the base.
Right.
So we got to Quan Loi, And come to find out, we weren't supposed to be in Quang Loi, our part of the unit.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to have gone to Phuc Vinh, which means halfway up Thunder Road or Highway 13, we were supposed to have taken a right and gone up north towards Phuc Vinh. So we had to wait for a convoy to assemble to get ready to go back down. Meantime, we sat around playing with the rubber, and if you stick a knife on a rubber tree and the white latex kind of comes out, it begins to dry very quickly, turns into this yellowish little stuff, and you roll it up in a ball, and you throw it, and since it isn't perfectly round, I mean bounce, this stuff just bounces in any direction. And I was very impressed with playing with the rubber. So we got finally a convoy was assembled. We headed out of Quang Loi, back down through An Lạc, which was a beautiful old French Indochinese town. And you could see the European accent in the architecture of the buildings. When I went through, I thought it was just beautiful. Went back down by convoy. This time I was riding on the back of a truck with a bunch of other guys. I forget why the change. We came to a Y in the road, and right in the middle of the Y was what was left, and it was still smoking, of an M113 armored personnel carrier. And some GIs were standing around. And the M113, the shell in the M113 is a magnesium aluminum alloy. And it apparently, since it was located right in the middle of the Y, I would assume it didn't hit a mine. I think it was hit by an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, their anti-tank rockets. And it caught fire. And just like helicopters, it just burns right down to a whitish ash, except for the steel parts. And that's all that was left there.
But it was a recent attack, apparently.
Yes, it was still smoking. And the GIs were all, you know, in a perimeter around the place. You could see that they were aware. All the rest of us became more aware. But nothing happened. We made it over to Phuc Vinh, which had been an old French post years and years earlier. Pulled into Phuc Vinh, found that the whole 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion was already there. I mean, we were supposed to be the advance element.
Right.
But we ended up in the wrong place, had to wait for the convoy, and meanwhile, they had already come and were already running missions like they had been there all the time. got back there. Ran some missions and the like. I was getting short at that time.
Right.
I was due to leave in December. Had already extended for the 101st Airborne Division, 327th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
You'd already made that decision?
Yeah, and it already, the paperwork had already gone through.
Can you tell me about making that decision and why you did that?
Well, there was no way in hell I was going to continue flying. I have to fly on June 1st. I have to fly out to Reno for the 173rd Airborne Brigade reunion, and I'm not looking forward to it. I have not liked flying ever since that period of my life.
Since that time with the first cab.
Yeah, right. As a gunner.
Why?
There were just too many times that came close to going down. And the falling thing is you're totally helpless. There were probably four occasions. I believe I told you about hitting a tree. I believe I told you about some artillery going off underneath us once, just about flipping us over. Told you about a near mid-air collision.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. That's the one that really scared me. We were 3,000 feet up there.
Right.
And it would have been a long way down. And then I saw, you know, a number of other ships go down, one aircraft. When I was a grunt, you know, I remembered back to times we were sent out to where ships had gone down. And I just didn't like to fly anymore. I got a fear of heights. Strange for a paratrooper. But that's what developed. I have it to this day.
Now, why did you re-up for another tour?
Well, I knew that if I extended,
mm-hmm.
I didn't re-up, I extended,
okay.
I would have only 5 months left when I got out, only 3 months left when I got out. And if you had less than 5 months remaining, they just let you out.
Right.
Because it wasn't worth the trouble of getting you back into garrison duty attitude.
Mm-hmm.
after things being a little bit looser in a war zone. So I considered that, and also, again, I was dedicated to the cause. I wanted to be in a combat position. The idea of being in the rear to me was, I don't know, I just always wanted to be in combat position.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go back to parachute infantry,
mm-hmm.
not realizing at the time that the 101st was converting over to an air cavalry unit. And when I got to them, come to, you know, it wasn't a paratroop. There was maybe about one-third of the men were paratroops, but everybody else was what we used to call a leg. But, I had also wanted to serve, the idea of serving with the three, what I considered the three best units in Vietnam, the 173rd Airborne Brigade, the 1st Cavalry Division, and the 101st.
Mm-hmm.
And I specifically wanted 1st Brigade 101st, because the 1st Brigade operated in Vietnam for 3 years before the rest of the division came over, and they were a damn good unit.
Why not go back to the States and finish out your?
I just garrison duty did not attract me at all. It's just details, polish your boots, training, keep your gig line straight, putting up with the Mickey Mouse.
Wouldn't it safer though?
Well, yeah.
I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm wondering.
I was young. I was looking for chills.
Right.
It's just that I found more chills in the air than I did thrills after a while.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there were thrills, but towards the end, suddenly, I just saw too much. The ship's going down, burning.
Mm-hmm.
At Phuc Vinh, after we got there, we'd been there for, a week maybe. And the mid-air collision that I told you about earlier, where the lead ship started to turn,
mm-hmm.
which means the second ship started to turn, and the lead ship straightened out, but the second ship didn't notice it. I just finished formation. I had that day off, so I was just doing details around the base. And we were right on the perimeter. And as I was walking away from the formation, two helicopters were flying around at about 100 feet, and they were being moved from one set of revetments to another set because they were going to be working on the first set.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming around the perimeter in a slight arc following the perimeter. And I looked at them, and suddenly something didn't look right. And I just couldn't figure out what it was for a second. And then to my horror, I realized what it was. The plane of the rotor blades of both ships was not the same.
Mm-hmm.
The first ship, again, had straightened out. The second ship hadn't picked up on it. And the rotor blades hit each other. The second ship, the blades just shattered and fell off, and the ship just fell like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible thing to see, because the crew chief jumped at the last moment.
Mm-hmm.
He had one chance in a million of jumping. But if he didn't jump, he had no chance at all, because there was no doubt the ship would explode when it hit. Number one, they were falling just outside the main wire, which was a minefield.
Mm-hmm.
There were mines from the French still out there. He wasn't able to jump very far from the helicopter, but still, I mean, we used to wear this armored vest, I think I talked about, called a chicken plate.
Mm-hmm.
It was inch-thick steel. with the weight and the like, and when you jump out of the helicopter, you're falling the same rate as the helicopter. And when it exploded, he wasn't that far away. And everybody on the ship was killed. The other front ship took severe damage. I don't know how they did it, but somehow, wobbling through the air, the pilot was able to get the ship just barely over the wire, inside the wire, land hard, and it flipped over on its side. I remember I took off running for the ship. It didn't explode. I was running for the ship, and other guys were running from the ship from every direction. And I was so intent on getting to the ship to help get these guys out, especially if any of them were trapped.
Mm-hmm.
I ran by three guys that were going in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, it didn't dawn on me, especially that they were wearing flight suits. We used to wear, when we were flying, we wore a special type of fatigue that were fire retardant,
mm-hmm.
and they looked a little different. I didn't pick up on it. I got to the helicopter, and guys had gotten there ahead of me, and they were crawling all over it, and they were looking, but it's like, where are they? Where are they?
Mm-hmm.
And then it dawned on me. I just ran past three guys. Now, here's the point. The crew was four people. There were only three men in that helicopter, that lead helicopter. This was a very quickie little thing. Just pick up the helicopters, move them around the side of the perimeter. They couldn't get a gunner, or they didn't take the time to get a gunner, who's on the right-hand side of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
The same position that I had when we almost had that collision. So that's basically forbidden. You have to fly with a full crew.
Mm-hmm.
If they had had a gunner, he might have seen that the other ship was still in a turn. Because the co-pilot and the crew chief on the other ship apparently didn't notice it.
Right.
But if there had been a gunner on the first ship on the right side, it might have made the difference. I mean, he could have screamed into the mic, you know, hard left, hard left.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a big investigation on that. Because actually, I mean, a lot of times the maintenance people, avionics people, things like that, they'd fly as gunners just to get some flight time and, fire the machine gun if necessary, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody would have done in a gunner's position, and everybody knew pretty well what the gunner's job was. But they didn't get anybody. And So there was an investigation of that. It wasn't complete by the time I finished. I'm sure somebody suffered for it, besides the four men that were killed.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that I saw jump, I had just met. I'd seen him around, but I just really met him about three nights earlier in a small party in the crew chief's quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And young, he's from California, I remember it. I can't remember his name right now offhand. And we really hit it off fantastically. But then between missions and like, I hadn't talked to him since then. And he was the guy that I saw jump.
Mm-hmm.
The tail rotor from that the whole tail boom from that helicopter remained around for a long time. I have pictures from a friend who's there, probably 3 months after I left,
mm-hmm.
and the tail boom was still laying out there. It was in the picture I noticed. I asked him, was that the tail boom from that ship? He
mm-hmm.
said, yeah, it was. That kind of double confirmed that I just, from then on, when I was a grunt in my third tour,
mm-hmm.
God, we got picked up to fly someplace, and I just tighten up. I want to land. I want to get down. I want to land. Mm-hmm. You know.
Right.
At this point, right now, if somebody offered me a ride in a Huey,
mm-hmm.
I would take it.
Okay.
But probably not more than once. and of course, I wouldn't have to do the land in the kind of or and take off from the kind of places, you know, that we had to then. I mean, we used to chop branches intentionally,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the rotor blades sometimes to get down. Well, I wouldn't be flying in such close formation and the like.
Right.
You know. But would I do it once again? Yeah, I would. Mm-hmm. A light aircraft doesn't bother me too much.
When you hear helicopters today, do you harken back to Vietnam?
A Huey? Mm-hmm. I mean, it'll freeze me. I'll hear it before anybody else will.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, it's very rare to hear one now.
Right.
Up until about 3 years ago, you would still hear them from National Guard units flying, or some police, state police, and like were given surplus UH-1s.
Mm-hmm.
But now the Army's gone over to the Black Hawk, and the National Guard has gone over to the Black Hawk, too. Also, I mean, interestingly, I've noticed on television watching them, the machine guns that the door gunners use in the Black Hawk,
mm-hmm.
is the exact same model we used in the Huey.
Right.
It's the M60D model. And I'm just very impressed that machine gun is still in use,
mm-hmm.
As a door gunner's gun. Black Hawk can lift a lot more. It can. It's much more maneuverable. It's a great ship, much bigger than a Huey.
Mm-hmm.
But that Huey was a very impressive helicopter, and it did yeoman work. I've often seen models of helicopters, and most of them, the model makers want to be dramatic. So it's some kind of an attack helicopter,
mm-hmm.
a Huey with guns and rockets mounted on it. Or, once in a while, a medevac. But I have never seen the standard Huey with a door gunner on each side. And I don't think the model makers ever realized, and I wrote a letter to one of them once,
mm-hmm.
saying, you don't realize what a market there is out there. Even people that weren't in the field, that were in the rear, that was such a common sound. And every one of them remembers that sound. You know, the rotation of the rotor blades, the whoop, 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 whoop. Everybody, and so many people were transported here and there with them, you know. Wounded guys, they could have made millions selling those things.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to stay with what they thought was dramatic. And they blew it. probably too late now. But they always wanted to go with something dramatic, especially gunships.
Right.
And I always got so disgusted. I bought one once. I took the rocket pods off it, and I took some little plastic soldiers, put one in each side. I got some with a machine gun. Out of pieces of plastic, I made the pylon and the mount for the gun,
mm-hmm.
and everything. It actually had something that looked halfway decent,
mm-hmm.
and it got smashed when I moved once. So.
Yeah.
But, they lost the chance there. Most Vietnam veterans will remember that sound in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I do hear it still, and I probably haven't heard it for about a year, I mean, I'll just freeze, and it'll take me back. I spent just so many hours in the air,
mm-hmm.
and both as a gunner and as a grunt.
At some point, though, you decided you did not want to be in the air anymore.
I didn't want the falling thing,
mm-hmm.
and the danger of the fire thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened too often. It happened. We had one ship go down. Guys were pinned in it. We were always told to tell people, you know, grunts and the like, don't hang your legs out over the side, especially when we're landing.
Right.
Because if something happens and it flips, you can fall and your legs will be pinned.
Right.
The ship catches fire, you've had it.
Mm-hmm.
And that did happen once, I remember, in our unit, to one of our ships anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was three guys, passengers, were pinned. get them out when the ship ignited. It uses jet fuel, which is known as JP1 or JP4. And once it ignites, you can't do anything else except save yourself. I really wanted to fly at first, and I loved it for about 4 months, but then, I just wanted out. I wanted my feet in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
At least you can get your head down on the ground.
Right, that's very true.
You can't do that in a helicopter.
Right.
Either that or you don't want to do that in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was fascinating. I know the First Corps, I Corps,
mm-hmm.
from the air, like the back of my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Landed, worked with Arvins on and off, with Marines.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little sort of competition or thing going with the Marines. Sometimes we'd fly over Dong Ha and drop tear gas grenades on their helicopter units, and they'd pay us back the same
mm-hmm.
way at night sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a friendly kind of thing, and we worked with Marines on and off.
Mm-hmm.
If we needed fuel and we're up in their area, we could land at any one of their places and fuel up, no problems, and vice versa.
What was your opinion on the Marine Corps?
On the Marine Corps?
The Marines that you worked with.
I can't really say who they were. The Marines needed somebody to land some supplies someplace. They used Hueys, but they preferred to use Sea Knights, which was a smaller tandem rotor than our tandem rotor, which was a CH-47.
Mm-hmm.
We always felt that, yeah, you can carry more men, but you got a greater danger because you've got two rotor blades to worry about
mm-hmm.
and the transmission. You lose one set and you're dead. And it was a bigger target. But they did have Hueys later on, a lot more of them. But still, they landed most of their troops by CH-46 Sea Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Our tandem rotor blade was a medium lift helicopter called a CH-47. And it was a little bit bigger, carried more supplies and the like, more men, more equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't carry troops unless it was going to an area that we knew was secured. Sometimes they'd secure an LZ with one or two lifts of Huey fill troops.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they spread out and they were sure nobody was there, then they'd have Chinooks bring in, 20, 30 guys at a time and detach the Hueys off to another mission. It was more economical
mm-hmm.
using a larger ship, but still, it was also a bigger target and easier to shoot down.
Right.
As far as, at that time, like I said, it was just little small favors for Marines. I don't remember taking Marines in, infantry in for landings.
Mm-hmm.
We did with South Vietnamese. We did with 3rd Brigade, 5th Mechanized Division Army. we did resupply South Vietnamese. A lot of liaison missions, that kind of thing. Different, I think I've discussed command and control missions before. Horribly boring,
mm-hmm.
and very cold.
Mm-hmm.
With SOG, regular known as ass and trash missions. Moving troops or moving supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Working with LERPs, those kind of things. It was something different every day.
Sounds like it.
And I can remember getting up early in the morning, and we were expected to report at 6 o'clock unless it was a special mission. I believe I talked about night missions.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Talked about, did several of those.
Did you prefer to fly at night or during the day?
I didn't fly close for formation at night. The night mission, when I flew maybe 4 or 5 times at night. One of them was the flare ship. If something happened, the flare ship would be up about, 8,000-10,000 feet, and we'd start kicking out these big magnesium flares.
Mm-hmm.
That would light up the whole area so that the gunships could see clear what was going on, things like that. There's nothing dangerous. It's kind of boring and cold. Flying down low, that was during the time I wasn't really, didn't really gain the fear of heights. I found it kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't bad. It was about the same as flying days at that
mm-hmm.
time.
What did you prefer, to fight on the ground at night or during the day?
Excuse me?
When you're on the ground, when you were a grunt, did you prefer the nighttime or the daytime as far as for combat missions and just your general impression?
Gee, it kind of depends on what kind of combat. If you're out on a patrol, a night patrol or an ambush, you don't really know the size of the unit you're facing.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, of course, it's a surprise engagement. Either somebody walks into our ambush, or we just happen to meet. I think during the day we could get in air support and reinforcements and the like a lot quicker, of
mm-hmm.
course. And you could identify your targets. At night, you had to be careful. Just firing could give away your position.
Mm-hmm.
So you generally didn't want to fire your weapon unless you had a definite target, which would be real close to you. Machine guns were the last weapon to fire at night because they gave away a position more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of night battles began with grenades because that way you didn't give away your position.
Mm-hmm.
Grenades and grenade launchers. And there's a lot of hearing. And when you can hear something but you can't see it, boy, your imagination can go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember spending a lot of nights pulling guard, out on some hill or something,
mm-hmm.
and imagining the whole North Vietnamese Army sneaking up on my position.
Right.
But I'd rather fight during the day.
Okay. Let's go to December 1968. This is right before you're transferring over to the 101st. What'd you do for Christmas?
Well, first of all, I left Phuc Vinh.
Uh-huh.
I went to Cameron Bay. No. Where did I go? Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Cameron Bay to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Had never been to Cameron Bay before. A lot of sand.
Mm-hmm.
Flew home.
Did you have 30 days again?
Yep.
Okay.
Extension leave. All extension leaves were 30 days, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't come off your regular leave time. I never did use any of my regular leave time. Got paid for it when I got out. I got home. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember actually arriving home right now. I remember the first time. I remember the third time. Anyway, I got home.
Okay.
And something big was happening, and that's my sister was getting married.
Uh-huh.
In January.
Okay.
And I got home probably middle of December. So we had Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
My stepfather's father had come out. Everything was all in an uproar.
In a good way or bad way?
Good way.
Okay.
When I was gunning, I'd gotten a Dear John letter from a girl I had proposed to on my
mm-hmm.
leave between the first and the second. That kind of was a little discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
I linked up with this other girl for a good part of my second leave.
Mm-hmm.
And So that made it a little bit exciting for me. It built my confidence back up again.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents receive you? How did your family receive you the second time?
As usual, you know, with relief, especially my mother.
Yeah.
Because it always went hardest on her. Unfortunately, my stepfather's father started to get sick. Started off with a bad cold. And we were sleeping in the same room. And I could hear him coughing, you know, more and more all the time. The cough was getting deeper and deeper and heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my sister's wedding came up. He was too sick to go to the wedding. We had the wedding at the NCO Club at Fort Devens. My stepfather was stationed there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
My real father and my stepmother came up because my sister was, you know, my real father's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So my stepfather pretty well raised us. So I got to see him too, you know, and all members of the family. She had the wedding. It was a lot of fun. She took off for their honeymoon. And her husband had just joined the Army. He was Army Security Agency. So after the honeymoon, he was going over to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
My stepfather's father then got real, real, real bad. And I suspected pneumonia. I told my stepfather, but I think his head was kind of all in a whirlwind. You know, me being home, Christmas, New Year's, the wedding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it really dawned on him just how bad his stepfather was, they took him into the hospital, I remember, and his cough was horrible. The amount of phlegm he was coughing up was horrible and everything. By the time they took him in, the doctor said, we'll take care of him, go home right now. They got home, and the phone rang, and his father died.
Wow.
And so that really put a damper on it.
Mm-hmm.
I had also linked up with an old friend that I had known in Germany. Mm-hmm. His father was stationed with my stepfather. So we were both Army brats in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And his father had been transferred back to Fort Devens, so, you know, there was somebody that I knew there, and he'd just been married. He had a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided, well, my leave was up. I'm going to go down and ask for a two-week extension to cover the funeral. And I went down to Fort Devens. We were living on Fort Devens.
Mm-hmm.
No, we were living just outside. That's right. They bought a house just outside of Fort Devens. And I went on post. I requested the 2 weeks, and they turned it down. So I said, to hell with it. What are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Draft me? Put me in the infantry? Send me to Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really start looking for you for about 6 months. By the time the unit reports that you haven't arrived back and it goes through channels, you know, and as long as you keep your dog tags on,
mm-hmm.
And as long as it's not over, I forget what it was, 6 months or a year back then, you weren't considered a deserter.
Okay.
Just AWOL. What the heck. So I stayed, actually enjoyed the remaining 2 weeks, and was thinking about taking a third week, and figured, wow, what the heck. My stepfather, he said, you know, be careful, Andy, you might get busted. I said, I'm only a spec 4, when you're going to bust me to PFC, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going to make a career. I was pretty sure of that. But then I decided, okay, 2 weeks is enough. So I went back, reported to Denwa, which was the then base camp of the 101st. For some reason, their base camp was way down south
mm-hmm.
in 3rd Corps, and they were way up north. I reported in, had some young lieutenant walk my heels and scream at me and threaten me with this and that and this and that. And I really just kind of blocked it out. And
is that because of your being 2 weeks late?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, the heck with it. I knew they weren't going to send me to jail for it or anything. I expected, yeah, I'll get a company Article 15. What the heck? Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
So he left. The personnel clerk motioned me over and I sat down. He said, the guy's a jerk. I mean, here you are coming over for your third tour, you know, and he's going to give you a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
And going back into a combat situation. So he had my personnel records, and he changed all the figures so that I had arrived on time,
huh.
The paperwork.
Okay.
And then he said, here, here's your, what do they used to call it? It's like a travel pay. You go to an airfield and you can travel ticket, travel something. I forget, boarding pass, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of here. So I took off. When I got to the 101st, they want me to go through their jungle school again. I don't want to do that. And I tried to walk out like I did during my second tour.
Right.
I didn't make it. So I had to take the whole thing over again.
Okay.
You know, even though the sergeants knew this was my third tour. And as a result, a little bit more was expected from me.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through the thing, and then reported to 1st Brigade, and then reported to 1st Battalion, 327th, which is the unit I requested,
mm-hmm.
and they assigned me to D Company. D Company at that time was guarding and pulling ambushes and the like, and daytime reaction, acting as a daytime reaction force, at a bridge along Highway 1 just south of Fubai.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have called it Fubai 2. Actually, it was Futui. We operated around there. They started up this 1st Battalion started up this little kind of reconnaissance team, a squad size with a machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it short, long-range patrol. It didn't go real far, you know, but it was out by itself, way off the highway out towards the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Short, long-range patrol, we called ourselves Slurps, jokingly.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave us camouflage fatigues and everything, and they had this very young ranger lieutenant give us some sort of special training that we all thought was a bunch of hooey. But we liked the idea of being out patrolling by ourselves and not just pulling ambushes and the like. So I was with them for, about a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out, we operated pretty much. I remember the first time we went out, got out there and found out that the machine gun, I was a machine gunner,
mm-hmm.
but the machine gun I was carrying only fired one round. And then you had to pull a cocking lever back to jack another round into the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the machine gun is a very important weapon. It's the most powerful weapon in an infantry squad.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a heavy weapon, but it makes up for it because it fires lots of bullets. Well, here I am carrying a 25-pound single-shot weapon. And I remember we called back in and said, can you fly us out another M60?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they said no. You're due to come back in about 5 days, just work with it till then, which didn't make any sense. So I kind of threw a little hissy fit. The squad was annoyed also. I mean, you depend on a machine gun. So then we said, well, look, why don't you just send a patrol halfway out to us, and then we'll meet it halfway. And they wouldn't do that either. So I had to walk around for those 3 or 4 days with that 25-pound single-shot weapon until
mm-hmm.
I got another one. And then we went right back out again. We kicked off two ambushes. We almost captured a North Vietnamese soldier. We were out in the area where there were no villages, right on the edge of that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were sitting up in a little temple. It was during the day, and I happened to look up the trail. It was coming in from the mountains. And here comes this North Vietnamese soldier. He had his rifle slung over his shoulder. He had his pith helmet on. And he's walking down the trail like he's back on the block someplace. totally surprised. And I said, look, there, let's sneak around. We can capture him, you know, by going around on this little hill. But we had this Filipino that joined the American Army.
Mm-hmm.
And Nilo got so excited, he just couldn't help himself. He picks up his rifle and he fires a round at the guy. And the guy is still 200 meters away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, boom, a round goes past the guy and he takes off. And that was a real shame because we could have captured that guy easily.
Mm-hmm.
I remember another time we had stopped, and this was at night, and off to a trail that wide off of the one that we were patrolling on. It was the night patrol. We suddenly heard some whispering. And the whispering was Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
So we started sneaking up very slowly. It could only be, you know, the North Vietnamese in this area. We probably got to within 15 meters of them when apparently they heard us. I remember a burst of automatic weapons fire went over our head. We all threw grenades and then fired. We weren't about to go down into this little draw where the word the voices were coming from, primarily because being a draw, if we went down in there, you'd be vulnerable from the other side of the draw.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know how many were there, you know. But we grenaded the devil out of it, and then called in some artillery back up to roughly where we felt they would have been if they were fleeing back up that trail. Next morning, we didn't find anything, their footprints and the like. So it was just one of those chance things. We just happened to sit down right next to where apparently a group of them were getting together and waiting for a certain time to come before they started working their way into the village to pick up rice taxes, intelligence information, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So another occasion we had a young, at this time they were running short of non-commissioned officers, so they started this program where it was kind of like a 90-day program.
Mm-hmm.
When you came out of that, you were an E5, a sergeant, basic park sergeant, and we used to refer to them as instant puddings, and usually they didn't learn. Well, obviously, they had no experience in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can get all the training in the world, but once you really need to have been in combat a little bit. And we remember there was some movement in it was getting dusk, and there was a movement across this open area in a tree line. And he's sitting there calling in artillery fire, and all of a sudden he said, "Everybody on line, advance to the tree line." Well, somebody said, "What are you talking about? You just called in artillery fire in that tree line."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, I called it in 100 meters behind it." And the RTO said, "No, you didn't. You called it in right on the tree line." And he insisted. And now, "Get up, everybody, let's go." And we're all, "Oh, my God." So we all got on line, and he started off, but we all kind of drug our feet because, you know, we knew we were pretty sure he definitely called in on that tree line. Sure enough, an entire volley, six rounds, came in on that tree line.
Mm.
We were far enough away so that nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little bit embarrassed about that to this day.
Yeah, what was the reaction at the time by the other men in the unit? What'd you guys do?
A lot of sarcasm.
Uh-huh.
He got better. But, you know, he was just a little bit too enthusiastic. That right there, you know, taught him, okay, calm down, listen to these other people for a little while until you learn something.
Mm-hmm.
But he got kind of joked, ribbed for that for a while. He transferred out of, he was transferred to 1st Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
I was in 3rd Platoon.
But your small unit, the Slurp, you were about a squad size, you said?
Yeah, this is a reinforced squad with a machine
okay.
gun.
Okay. And you operated about a month in and around this area, this bridge.
And then something really scary happened.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you, when I was a door gunner, we used to fly these missions at night, and we'd fly with the searchlight on, right down close to the ground, and right up behind us would be gunships, and the gunners would be there with their fingers right on the trigger, and the second they saw anything, remember I told you they'd open fire, and the ship would break either left or right, and the gunships would take over. Well, we're out in this area, and it's bushes, maybe at the most 4 feet high. There's a tree line a couple hundred meters away. And I happen to notice off to the northeast, here's one of these night hunter killing missions. Now, this must have been a kilometer away. I didn't think too much of it. And so we're slowly moving along this trail. It's at night. It's probably about midnight or so. And I happen to notice that, gee, they're kind of heading in our direction. But I didn't think too much of it, because what are the chances that out of 360 degrees, and when you're moving too, that they're going to come right over you? Well, Murphy's Law worked very strangely that night. They got closer, and they got closer, and they got closer, and they started to get so close, I warned the squad leader, hey, something's wrong here. Because, number one, they're not supposed to be operating in an area where there's any friendlies or civilians. And these guys are getting real close to us. And I said, I used to do this. The second, if they spot us, the second they see, they're not going to ask any questions or take too much time to identify. They're just going to open fire. And they kept getting closer and closer, and they're coming right for us. Well, they're doing a slight zigzag, you know? Damn, they're coming right for us. And they're getting closer and closer, and I said, oh, God, we're in trouble. And I told them there's two gunships behind them, and everybody jumped into the bushes. And I'm under this bush, and I'm thinking, what should I do? I don't have a helmet on. We didn't wear helmets in this little recon squad. We wore these floppy caps, kind of like the North Vietnamese did a lot. And I'm thinking, I could jump out suddenly and hold up my M16, you know? But at the same time, they just plain see a movement. I mean, I've done this job. And you just react and fire. And you can react and fire and then realize what you see, but that it can be too late. By the time you can communicate it to the pilot so they can communicate it to the gunship, the first rockets and miniguns can be landing. And I just did not, I was terrified. I just hid under that bush, kind of curled up, told everybody to do the same thing. The light went right over us.
Wow.
And the bushes were not that thick. I was, I'm surprised to this day they didn't see us. And they just kept on going, and I told squad, get on the radio. Somebody is in the wrong place. And, you know, and we could have been killed, for one thing. So they got on the radio and called the company, and company said they'd call battalion, and battalion had to find out what unit, aviation unit, was flying the mission, and I never really heard what happened. But somebody was out of place that day. Either we were where we weren't supposed to be, or they were where they weren't supposed to be. But it was very terrifying for me. We continued patrolling, little small actions, a couple of kills. And then they decided to move the battalion, actually the whole brigade, 1st Brigade, further south to the north end of the Da Nang Pass. The Da Nang Pass is also known as the Hai Van Pass. And the mountains come right out to the ocean. It's a beautiful drive. You're on the edge of these hills, these cliffs like, that go right down to the ocean. And then occasionally there's little villages where a stream or something flows into the ocean and has deposited enough soil so there's like a little U-shaped area for a village to be. And the village at the very northern part was called Phu Lac. And that's where my company was stationed. was a village called Troy, and that's where another one of our companies was stationed. South of that was around an area called Los Banos, which was one of many artillery bases along Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
The railroad came up through, passed underneath two hills. On top of one was a small base, a fire support base called Fire Base Tomahawk.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went through Phu Lock, and then it went in through another tunnel, which passed underneath a Navy-run, a Seavey's-run rock crusher that made asphalt,
mm-hmm.
because we were turning Highway 1 into an all-weather highway. Across from that, there was a little peninsula that jutted out into this bay called Cowhai Bay. And on top of that hill was another fire support base, and its name was, ironically, Fire Support Base Roy. It had originally been started by the Marines. Tomahawk also had been started by the Marines. The Marines had operated in that area for years. Historically, the north end of the Dunning Pass for several hundred years was the border between the medieval nation of Champa and Nam Viet.
Right.
The Dai Viet, the original Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And that area had to have been very heavily fortified. And I didn't know this at the time, but there was no sign of anything on any of those hills. But looking back at it, and I even have the maps and the like, topographical maps, and that had to have been so heavily fortified.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, right behind it was Vietnam's only national park, a place called Bac Ma. And from Phu Lock, if you looked up towards Bac Ma, which is a big high mountain with big high mountains on either side of it, right on the very lip, you could see ruins of these houses. Well, those houses were houses that the French had for themselves during the colonial period.
Mm-hmm.
And during the hot season, they'd go up there and live. These were like summer homes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was cooler up there because of the altitude, and they didn't have all the heat and the bugs and everything else, and they had beautiful houses, and there was a whole town up there. It was all pretty well destroyed, and I always wanted to go up there,
mm-hmm.
but only one time we almost went when an observation plane was shot down, but then some LARPs reached it. But I never did, and I used to look at it through binoculars. It was kind of fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that was Vietnam's only national park, and it was kind of like who was ever there at the time actually owned it. Behind that, the mountains got extremely steep. Again, I've looked at the topographical maps, and the contour lines are so close together that they almost form a solid black area.
Hmm.
I've been over mountains like that, and oh, that's rough traveling with a rucksack.
Mm-hmm.
Our basic job was to, at night, pull ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
The company broke up into three platoons to the north part of this little valley. It was one platoon. In the middle part was my platoon, and the southern part was another platoon,
mm-hmm.
and the company headquarters was where the advisatorial compound was, right along Highway 1 in the center of Phu Lock. And it's an old compound from the French days, military compound.
Mm-hmm.
Combination Allied, South Vietnamese, whatever. And usually we'd set up during the day in an abandoned temple or an abandoned school. The school was abandoned because all the teachers had either been killed or intimidated not to come to work. So the school wasn't used. And this was common practice by the North Vietnamese, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Each platoon would usually break down into three squads each at night. And during the day, we'd pull patrols, and we'd just kind of look around and for an ambush site, and as you're walking, you don't stop and, you know, look around. Yeah, this looks like a good spot. You just keep going. The officer, you know, just eyes the place as you keep going, but you don't, because the North Vietnamese up in the hills are watching you at all times. And what their job was to come into the village, to pick up a rice tax, anything else, to coordinate with any Viet Cong infrastructure, pick up intelligence information, on and on and on, and then go back into the hills. And our job was to intercept them, plus to provide security, so no larger-scale enemy units could come in. The next village up, village called Troy, later on during the final days of the war, the North Vietnamese cut Vietnam into different sections coming out of the mountains, and they did it at Troy. They couldn't do it at Phu Loc, but they did it at Troy. The goal was to take Phu Loc, though, because once you took Phu Loc and you got in there with a good-sized force, you cut Highway 1, and you could defend that little area halfway well. That was a major, major battle. The South Vietnamese Army and the South Vietnamese militia that were located in that area put up an excellent fight until they just plain ran out of ammunition because we had cut them off. When I was there, the militia was nothing to write home about. It was typical militia.
Right.
That's all. Lousy militia, actually. Militia is militia. And these were probably popular forces, which means they only operated around their village, compared to regional forces, which only operated in the district. And they were there, and they were supposed to be pulling ambushes, too, but they never really seriously pulled ambushes.
So you really couldn't rely upon them at all?
No, not at all.
Did everybody feel that way, or is that your opinion?
Yeah, everybody felt that way.
Okay.
During Tet, a few turncoats had gone and opened up the gate to let North Vietnamese / Viet Cong in and overrun the compound. They took the compound back very quickly, the South Vietnamese Army did. We had an interpreter with us. He came from Hue. His name was An. But he was AWOL most of the time, with his girlfriend up in Hue.
Okay.
Interesting guy, funny guy, but, you know, when he was with us, that was nice. And when he wasn't, well, we just did without. So,
was anybody in your platoon, or I guess in the squad that would go out tonight, could any of you speak Vietnamese, or some Vietnamese?
No. And I've always regretted that I didn't learn more. I really have regretted that. But it's not like I had time to learn it. And to learn an Asian language when you speak a Latin language is a lot to it. But I think the military should have given us, I think I've said this before, more cultural training. This is the first time I really operated around civilians. And I wasn't totally surprised because I'd been around foreigners before. But a lot of the guys, a combination of they hadn't been around foreigners, had hardly been out of their towns for that matter, and were young and socially immature, did some things that, you know, we wouldn't like to see foreign soldiers doing around us, but still it was they were kids, you know. To me, I had learned a few Vietnamese words. When I passed an elderly person, you just lower your head a little bit, you put your hands together like a prayer, and you touch your forehead three times. And that's either a sign of honor or you're asking forgiveness or something, depending on the context of the situation. And I'd also always say, Chabak, if it was an old woman, and Chaung, if it was an older man, Chako, if it was a girl, and I forget what boy was.
Chowan.
Basic, huh?
Chowan.
Well, you got me in that one. But basically, you know, I had learned, especially with elderly people, mm-hmm. that they're highly regarded, and a girl, not so much the boys, mm-hmm. but you better show some respect for the girls. And when you got a bunch of young males, you know, that's something you really got to watch. But
right.
my God, at least to the priests and mm-hmm. to the elderly people, give this little sign of respect.
Mm-hmm.
But most guys, and what are you doing? Just said hi. Well, what would you do the thing? Well, that's how you kind of, screw that, you know.
So a lot of the guys did not share your...
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. And it didn't, I don't think it made a lot of enemies for us, but it didn't help,
mm-hmm.
you know, because in my opinion, and I think Mel will tell you the same thing, that we were considered the lesser of two evils.
Right.
I see it's 20 after.
Yes, we're beyond our time.
Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.
Thanks.
Like